We kick today's BPR off with attorney Chris Fabrican of the Innocence Project. He'll describe the Justice Department's look into FBI testimony on hair samples. 96% flawed. 33 of those defendants sentenced to death, 9 executed. We'll ask him and you what should be done to right this gross injustice. Then, after talking to the world's most renowned underwater photographer, Brian Scurry, we'll return to a similar criminal justice theme with a guy who wrote the New York Times piece on the supermax prison Tsarnaev will likely be shipped to if the jury decides to spare his life.
Andrew Cabral, the former sheriff of Suffolk County and public safety secretary, gives us her take on that supermax prison and America's soaring incarceration rate. Michael Norton from Harvard Business School on the IKEA effect. Wait till you hear this. Then the wild, crazy, forever zany local playwright Ryan Landry on his latest bit of brilliance, Thoroughly Muslim Millie. All that coming up.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So the Justice Department has acknowledged that the FBI used the pseudoscience of hair analysis and what could be nearly 3,000 cases. 26 of these numbers are amazing. 26 of the 28 FBI examiners exaggerated forensic matches in ways that favored prosecutors more than 95% of the 268 trials that have been reviewed so far. Here it is, though. The most outrageous news to date is in more than 30 of these cases, the defendants received the death penalty. 9 of those defendants have been executed. Chris Fabrican is the director of strategic litigation for the Innocence Project. He's calling the FBI's use of hair analysis a, quote, mass disaster for the criminal justice system. Fabrican is also representing George Perot, a man who has served 30 years in prison because of evidence based on a single strand of hair. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Chris. So tell people how you guys at the Innocence Project got onto this whole debacle with the hair. How'd this happen?
Well, I mean, the Innocence Project has known about the problems with hair microscopy for a long, long time. And, you know, any first-year statistics and probabilities student would tell you that the statements that were being made by hair comparison experts were scientifically invalid from the beginning. The problem really, I mean, hair microscopy has been around for over a century. And but really, post-World War II, when the FBI developed its elite crime lab, the technique was professionalized, and what had been simply essentially eyeballing evidence and taking a look at two hairs and saying that, you know, they could have come from the suspect became a very elaborate show that was put on for juries where they would do visual demonstrations of the interior characteristics of hair and show them to juries and alleging a purported match. But the evidence that they didn't have, the data that was missing, was they had no idea how rare or how common the associations that they were making between suspect and crime scene hairs were. And as a result, they exaggerated, grossly exaggerated, the probative value of that association by claiming that it was the defendant's hair to the exclusion of everybody else on the planet, or using invented statistics and probabilities that were based on their own experience, or sometimes they would simply claim that their own work, they'd never failed to be able to distinguish between two hairs and suggest to jurors that an individual human hair was essentially unique. When even during this time, they knew that your hairs on the human head, on one individual's human head, have great variability between hairs. So not only are they not unique to a particular individual, they're not unique on a particular individual's head.
So they knew that they were lying.
Or exaggerating, well, you know, cooking the books.
Well, you know, I mean, there's only really two explanations for what happened. It's either gross scientific illiteracy for decades out of the most prestigious crime lab in the country, or something deliberate, or something in between. I think that there were many good actors that were from that unit and that believed in their own invalid testimony and that they thought that they could use their own bench experience as a workaround for the lack of a valid database. And then there were other bad actors that shaded their testimony toward the prosecution because they believed the defendants were guilty and that they wanted to help convict them.
Yeah, but yeah,
so it's
know.
Incompetence or corruption. Either choice, and neither is a very good choice, I guess. I'm sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
You know, Chris, there's a piece of one of your board members, I think he's on the board, Eric Lander from MIT, writes in the New York Times the other day, which I'm sure you saw. He talks about these three guys, Odom, Tribble, and Gates, served 7 years in prison between them, all exonerated. And he mentions one prosecutor, I'm reading now, put at the odds at perhaps 1 in 10 million, as you suggested, that the hairs belong to someone other than the defendant. And it turns out in one of them, the hair sample, none of the hair samples match the defendant, despite those alleged odds. And one was from a dog. So even if you say, even if you give them the benefit of the doubt in some cases, that in these 96%, which is obviously not outliers, 26 of these 28 FBI examiners, in an egregious situation like that, you have to be either dumb as a stone or crooked to be given that kind of testimony, don't you?
Yes. I'm not sure there's another way to put it. It's, you know, even if it was a subjective belief in that the examiner who gave that testimony actually believed it, there's a court failure to preclude that grossly unreliable evidence from reaching a jury to begin with. And that was the court's responsibility to rein in that type of, you know, wild testimony from an expert. And an expert that's given the imprimatur of expert and a scientist by the court and proffered to a jury as somebody that you can trust, somebody that's unbiased, somebody that's a scientist interested in only the validity of their conclusions and doesn't have a stake in the outcome of the proceedings. We know today that that's not so.
Chris Fabricant, why did the Justice Department, even though on its face, if I assume if people are objective listening to the show, they'd say this is pretty horrible stuff, they should fix it. The Justice Department, is under any president, is not known for saying, yeah, we really screwed up, let's look into it and provide some statistical backup. Why did they agree to what you and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers wanted? Why did they agree to do this analysis of their own FBI?
The three exonerations that you pointed out earlier in Washington, D.C., that were done by Sandra Lubick, who's the head of special litigation at the Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C., were very high profile in that there were three different hair examiners. They were all from the FBI hair comparison unit, and all three of those convictions really rested almost entirely on hair comparison evidence. And each one of those prisoners spent decades in prison based on, you know, a single hair. And I think that the media pressure at that point, combined with, you know, we had already had nearly 70 wrongful convictions that were that implicated hair comparison evidence. So the evidence just became overwhelming. and the FBI lab had had a couple of other previous scandals in the ensuing decade, you know, since they stopped using hair comparison evidence. And I think that there was a legitimate fear that somebody would be falsely executed and that would not be able to undo the damage done by hair comparison testimony. And they decided that, and they should be applauded for recognizing the limits of the evidence that as a matter of science and doing something to correct the record. For the first time in history, the Department of Justice is waiving procedural barriers to relitigating these cases. In other words, they're not going to raise things like statute of limitations or evidence that the defendant should have known earlier that there were problems with hair microscopy evidence, which we are seeing in state courts.
Chris,
it's really – go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to get back to the remedies here and the litigation and them not standing in the way, at least procedurally, in terms of these things. You mentioned that these cases were single hair cases. And I assume what you're saying is the conviction was totally based on this hair match issue. I mentioned the opening that the research suggests more than 33 of these people in the initial round of, I guess, 268 cases that they've so far completed an analysis of were sentenced to death penalty. Nine of them were executed. In the executions, were any of those, as far as you know, ones in which the critical piece of evidence was the hair match, or was it just one of a number of things that led to the conviction of that individual, those individuals?
I'm not that familiar with the individual cases where there were executions. I don't believe that any of them involved a single hair. Mm-hmm. to the exclusion of other evidence. But I will point out, and I think that it's important for people to understand, that scientific evidence is given great weight by jurors. And unlike things like even eyewitness identification evidence or other types of traditional techniques that are used to convict defendants, is because it's viewed as objective and it's viewed as, you know, scientific evidence, infallible scientific evidence of guilt. And unlike, you know, a lay witness that may be biased or have an axe to grind with the defendant or be traumatized by the experience, or an eyewitness that was in the dark or drunk or some other problem with the identification that a defense attorney can point up to a jury, this type of evidence is very, very difficult to undermine. So I think that it's the rare case where it could be considered really trivial evidence. Otherwise, it wouldn't be introduced.
We know Chris Fabricant, and by the way, that's the voice of Chris Fabricant from the Innocence Project. I'm thinking of all the television shows and the detective stories that regular people watch and read all the time, and so much of it is about forensics. And they're thinking, you know, and then they finally get in the jury, and here comes the hair evidence, or here comes the ballistics guy, or here comes the bite mark person. And apparently, there's a lot of problems with ballistics and bite mark testimony as well. Thinking, as you just said, well, this about wraps up the case. Tell us about your own client who was convicted of a rape and home invasion in Springfield, Massachusetts, right in our backyard, and what his situation is with a single hair.
Right. I would be remiss not to highlight a forensic discipline that you just highlighted. Bite mark comparison evidence is really the worst offender of the unreliable forensic discipline. There is no probative value whatsoever in bite mark analysis, and it should be eliminated from use in criminal trials altogether today.
Well, okay. before you leave that, the same Lander guy, one of your board members, writes in that same New York Times people, people in Mississippi released two men who had been convicted of separate murders based on testimony. Their teeth perfectly matched bite marks, and it turns out the bite marks were likely caused by, I don't know if you say crawfish or crayfish, and insects nibbling on the corpses. It's almost like SNL stuff if it were not dealing with people's lives. It's surreal.
Yeah, one of those was a capital conviction. You know, I mean, in June, I will be arguing together with the Mississippi Innocence Project the case of Eddie Lee Howard, a death penalty case in the Mississippi Supreme Court that also rests nearly entirely on bite mark comparison evidence. There are at least 15 people on death row right now that bite mark comparison evidence played a part in putting them on death row. There was a recent study released, or not released, there's been an effort to suppress it, but there was a recent inter-analyst reliability test conducted by the American Board of Forensic Odontology, the board certifying entity for bite mark experts, that suggests that not only are they not capable of associating a particular teeth with a particular bite mark, but that board certified experts with 20 years average experience were unable to distinguish in any kind of agreement a bite mark as opposed to a different type of an injury. In other words, the threshold inquiry as to whether or not the injury is a bite mark or not, that the experts are not capable of saying that with any degree of reliability. So that evidence is still admissible in court today. I mean, we lost a Frye hearing in this 2 years ago here in New York City, speaks to the problem of criminal courts blindly accepting, so-called scientific evidence by anybody in a lab coat.
So again, Chris Fabricant, is the bite mark deal incompetence and just stupidity, or is it corruption?
Well, I mean, I think that the experts themselves, despite all the evidence to the contrary, have a subjective belief that they can do this, and that, you know, that there may be problems with the discipline, but they personally are really expert in this, and they're very conservative with their opinions. But
okay.
The evidence, you know, I mean, is, you know, there isn't a single proficiency test that suggests they can do what they claim to be able to do. There's been a consistent effort to silence dissent within their own ranks. If there is a 19,000-word story by Radley Balco in the Washington Post about the board certifying entity's effort to drive out Mike Bowers the most prominent critic of bite mark analysis. So it's a very ugly political fight that really has nothing to do with justice. And the problem, of course, is that there are people, as I say, that are on death row that were put there by bite mark analysis, and there's never been a reckoning as to, you know, what we know today is a grossly unreliable technique that, you know, as I say, should never be admitted in any criminal trial.
You know, we interrupted your beginning to tell the story of your Massachusetts client with this bite mark thing. Mm-hmm. Finish that story, if you would, Chris.
Yeah. George Perrott was a 17-year-old young man, and decades ago that was, as you say, convicted of a rape and home invasion of an elderly woman. The woman, there were two trials. The woman who, the victim in this case, she never identified Mr. Perrott. She looked at a lineup that included him and failed to identify him. She described somebody, her attacker, that did not match Mr. Perrott's description in both trials, and she repeatedly insisted that he looked not like Mr. Perrott. The prosecutor in that case, in the first trial, forged an alleged confession by Mr. Perrott and forged his signature on that confession in an effort to get a second alleged perpetrator to confess. As a result, that conviction was reversed, and they retried the case. And the critical evidence in the case was testimony by an FBI hair examiner that that he matched a hair that was found in the victim's bed. And the FBI has conceded error in that case and said that, you know, that all three types of errors, in other words, suggestion that the hair at issue could only have come from Mr. Perrott, also claiming that there was a statistical weight to the association, and also using the examiner used his own experience to suggest that the association was highly probative evidence of guilt. The FBI's letter conceding error we received last summer. My co-counsel in this case are really fantastic lawyers who are doing pro bono work from Ropes and Gray in Boston. And they have been doggedly pursuing DNA testing in this case for many years. And, you know, we've been unable to find the evidence. And then during the course of this litigation, the FBI's hair audit was announced, and the Innocence Project became involved in Mr. Perrott's case as a result. And so we haven't been able to find the evidence to have it retested. Mr. Perrott was desperate to have that evidence tested to clear his name. He's been in prison for nearly 30 years based on what we know is scientifically invalid testimony. The Commonwealth in this case has raised procedural barriers in this case in an effort to elevate procedure over due process rights. And, you know, we are arguing, of course, to the contrary. We expect a hearing sometime this summer, and we hope and expect that the court will fairly weigh the materiality of the evidence at issue, and we hope and expect that Mr. Perrott will receive a new trial as a result.
Now, Chris Fabregan, what's interesting is Marjorie and I both staring at each other. We had the attorney general in here the other day, Maura Healey, who's the new attorney general, and one of the things we talked to her about was the Justice Department report on these hair matches. And we asked her specifically, one, what her opinion was, and she was, I think it's fair to say, appalled by it. But we then said, were there any cases in Massachusetts, as far as she knew, which might be affected by this? And admittedly, she's only been there 3.5 months. Her answer was no. How's that possible?
Well, I can only assume that she wasn't aware of Mr. Perrott's case.
Okay.
But
when you say authorities, do you mean
who's blocking this? Who's blocking this case?
Right.
What are the things that have come in your way from the government in Massachusetts?
Well, it wouldn't have been the Attorney General's office that were opposing us.
This is the District Attorney's office?
Right.
Which
it's
one?
The District Attorney.
It's Hamden County?
Hamden County. District Attorney. So I don't want to impugn the
We don't either. And by the way, you surely don't need to take advice from us, but I would contact Maura Healey's office because she seemed to be quite concerned about these findings that were released by the Justice Department.
Yeah, Lisa Kavanaugh, who's the director of the CPCS Innocence Program, and together with the Attorney General, I think are making efforts to start a local state-based hair microscopy audit, you know, and there is such an audit ongoing in Texas, we know about, and there's an effort to get one going in Illinois. And what is, you know, and as I pointed out earlier, is the real issue, you know, beyond the FBI's hair audit and those 3,000 cases that you referenced, is that people like the FBI's hair and fiber unit conducted two-week trainings for state hair microcystists for years, and they trained 500 to 1,000 different state hair experts, and they trained them to give the same invalid testimony that they gave in all of these cases. So it's really a virus that's spread throughout the criminal justice system, and it's going to take a Herculean effort by all constituents to right the wrongs here, and everybody roll up their sleeves and identify the cases and not fight about procedural rules and procedural objections, but to do justice in these cases, because it's a massive problem.
You know, Chris Fabricant, I don't understand what's going on here. I mean, you mentioned before that some of these experts begin to believe they're experts, even though they're not experts. And I understand where, you know, there may be people worried about, you know, expert witnesses, as you know, go around, they make a living off being expert in witnesses, and they want to hold on to their job and stuff. But you certainly don't start out at the FBI wanting to send innocent people off to prison or to the, you know, to get executed. So what, I can't understand why there weren't any whistleblowers over all these years, or, you know what I mean? What's going on here?
Well, there have been whistleblowers. There was a man named Fred Whitehurst who had pointed out some of these errors many years ago, and it resulted in a Department of Justice investigation by the Inspector General, Michael Bromwich, in 1999 on the FBI's, it was really focused more on the explosives unit. And I should point out that Mike Bromwich is also part of the team that negotiated this current FBI hair comparison audit. So there have been problems. They have been known, you know what I mean? And there was evidence that goes back to 1985, an international symposium on hair comparison that was hosted by the FBI. And there were people there, experts there, statistics and probabilities experts, including Peter DeForest, who's at John Jay University in Manhattan, that said, you know, there's real problems here. You can't use your bench experience to claim a probative weight to these associations you are making. And there was scholarly critique for some time around hair comparison evidence as well. But all of those were swept aside by courts and by the examiners who, to the extent that they're aware of them, you know, ignored them. So it's very, you know, I mean, and, you know, we at the Innocence Project really stress and advocate for root cause analysis to figure out what it is that happened, why this gross incompetence was allowed to continue for as long as it did. And in a root cause analysis, it really should not be in a blame culture. It should be treated like an airline crash. And that when an airline goes down, it isn't a culture of prosecution and blame and finger pointing. What it is that you look at how this was allowed to happen, why it happened, and put in places to prevent it from happening again. And this is why we advocate for national standards on forensic sciences. Right now, you know, that what somebody says in Massachusetts is different than somebody says in Texas, which is different than somebody says in California, and there are no rules. And beyond the national standards that need to be developed, you know, hopefully through the National Commission of Forensic Sciences and the White House Office of Science and Technology, there also needs to be validation research done. And that's currently underway by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And, you know, what's scary is that these venerable techniques are only now being researched. The basic research that needs to be done to validate some of the conclusions that have been offered and accepted in courts for decades.
Hey,
so, you know, I mean, we're really at the embryonic stage of cleaning up the disaster that unreliable forensic evidence has brought on our system.
Chris Fabricant, one more minute, last question from us. I know you don't want to play the blame game, but I do just for a second. Two quick questions. One, will anything happen to any of these examiners who either irresponsibly or incompetently or worse gave this testimony, or is essentially, are they history?
Well, you know, I mean, it really remains to be seen. Their bite mark experts have been successfully sued for providing, you know, an unvalidated and unreliable testimony that led to wrongful conviction. I suppose the same could be said for hair comparison experts. But, you know, our primary focus is justice and righting the wrongs.
That's my last question. Let's assume you're successful, and we hope you keep people surprised on the Perot case and cases like that. At the end of the day, if you're able to get them out, and while I'm surely not arguing this compensates anybody for 33 years of their life wrongfully taken away, are they generally financially compensated? Do there have to be in most states?
Far less frequently than they should. Far less frequently. The a large part of the policy work that the Innocence Project is engaged in is getting adequate compensation for the wrongfully convicted. Very, very frequently, somebody will be handed $5 and a bus ticket without an apology and sent out into the world after wrongful conviction for decades, destroying a life. It's a great, great tragedy, and it's really unconscionable the way that the wrongfully convicted are sometimes treated by states.
You're doing wonderful work. InnocenceProject.org. Chris Fabricant, thanks so much for the time. We really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Fabricant is the Director of Strategic Litigation for the Innocence Project. Coming up, we're going to ask you, clearly, innocent men and women have been incarcerated, some sentenced to death. How is a society, can we repay them, should we repay them, and what do you think about these startling and really horrifying revelations? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. You just heard us speaking to Chris Fabricant from the Innocence Project about the FBI using the now debunked method of hair analysis as evidence to incriminate someone, evidence that has been used to incarcerate and possibly execute innocent people. Our question to you is simple. How does society repay its debt to the innocent who spent years, often decades, in prison? If you go on the Innocence Project website, by the way, you'll find cases like this. Angel Gonzalez, 20 years in prison, innocent. Kathy Woods, 35 years, innocent. Joseph Sledge, 37 years, innocent. What do we do? Is there anything we can do to right these wrongs? And by the way, the final thing I asked Chris Fabricant, what happens to the people who provided this phony testimony that led to incarceration or possibly, we don't know for sure, death in these nine executions? The number is 877-301-8897. He said at the end of my question, Marjorie, that states are very bad about this. My recollection, the only case I can think of, Bobby Joe Lester. Remember that? Tom Finner was involved in that?
Yes.
Where there was they had to do an affirmative appropriation, I think it was of several hundred thousand dollars, that there's not a fund that's readily available. And I think there's some immunity, some caps or something. The bottom line is, I mean, while you can never repay, obviously, somebody for missing 30 years of their life, their children growing up, whatever they have lost out on, most importantly, I guess, their freedom, one would hope there'd be some financial compensation. You hear when Fabricant said, often it's a bus ticket and
$5.
Sorry.
No, it's like in the Shawshank Redemption. You leave in your little suitcase and they send you off to be a bagger at the supermarket. You know what's really scary about this? I mean, there's been a lot of debunking of the, not total, but questioning the reliability of eyewitness testimony. So we got that to be questioned, whether people can really identify the people that murdered their friend or raped them or whatever it
because
was.
Because of the not because they're lying, because of the emotion of the moment, the
yeah.
frenzy,
it
all that sort
good
of stuff.
Intentions.
Yeah.
I'm not impugning their motives. I think they just mistakenly identify the wrong people, and it often happens, obviously, with white people identifying black men in these cases. And then you have questioning ballistics. And you're questioning hair. Now, as you just talked about that, and you're questioning bite marks. So you think, really?
DNA. That's it.
That's it.
It's the only reliable. 877-301-8971.
Videos. Cameras.
True. But let me say, can you imagine? It's obvious. Can you imagine? It's one thing to go to jail.
No.
We're going to talk to Mark Benelli at 12 o'clock to talk about what the Supermax prison is like in Colorado that Tsarnaev is likely to end up in should he be found, should the jury decide not to give him the death penalty. Can you imagine being sentenced to jail?
No. Nope.
Spending 2 years, 10 years, 20 years when you didn't do anything and you know that the prosecution, that the government, either intentionally or out of ineptitude, cook the case against you? I mean, how do you live when everybody says, of course you say you're not guilty. You're lying.
Everybody's seen that movie Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
they play it like a millions
ever.
Of times.
You know who wrote that?
Who?
Stephen King.
Oh, that's right.
One of the most incredible writings. Yeah.
And this was a state prison. It wasn't the Supermax thing we're going to talk about later in the show, but it was a state prison. But it gave you that sense of having no control over your life with that sadistic warden and how horrible he was to everybody. And the guy, of course, the lead character was in there. He had not mm-hmm. murdered his wife, it turned out. And he had to face the fact that he was in jail for all those years for something he didn't do. He escaped.
One of the best movies of all time.
Oh, my God. If people haven't seen it, it is a great movie.
Let's squeeze in a couple of calls if we can. Madeline, you're in Roslindale. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think at the very least, given all of the lost earnings of people that have been incarcerated unjustly, that we should be giving them at least $15,000 a year for every year that they have lost. I mean, that's approximately minimum wage.
That's right.
We should be giving them, because it's all those years that they couldn't earn, you know, or maybe they earned, you know, 50 cents an hour at some prison job or something. But that's just so completely unfair and outrageous.
Well, you know, it's really horrible, too, and you've interviewed people in this situation, so have I, that they have been in jail for 15, 20 years, and then they get out, and there's this huge gap in their employment, and they have been in prison, and it's very difficult for those people to get jobs or to even function in those jobs, because there's a lot of, as you can imagine, pent-up psychological problems.
Well, not only that,
a lot
of people believe, well, they got off on a technicality. They probably did something. Madeline, thanks for the call. I don't want to mention his name only because I'm not sure of the facts. Right, one of the people you're talking about is, I interviewed a couple of years ago, a rapist who had done almost 30 years in jail. He got a very significant amount of money, and in part because my boss at the time, Iris Adler, did this terrific documentary at NECN about him. He finally got out, got a ton of dough. No ability to live in the real world, and not because he was an evil soul, but because of the reasons you suggested. So even though the money was there,
he was a young man.
Missed his kids growing up.
He was a black guy, big guy. If you saw him on the street, you say this is a well built, tough man, and it was difficult for him to cope with the normal kind of things at work that drive people crazy. But because of his imprisonment, the things that would cause a regular person just to get maybe a little bit ticked off caused him to get really ticked off, and it was really hard for him. It was so sad.
Rob, let's go to Warwick, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Rob.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I was actually going off what Marjorie was saying about, you know, how they get put out of the workforce. This is just regular prisoners. I mean, imagine if you did spend all that time in jail. So I think that the government should provide a job for these people that are incarcerated and give them money. So they're kind of getting two functions, you know, maybe minimum wage, as what that last caller suggested, but on top of that, they have some sort of job provided for them by the government. And I think that also the government should provide maybe some work program or something like that for prisoners, because if they get out of jail, and what do? They have a huge gap history, as you just said, and what are they going to do? They're going to go back to do what they did before to get money, which might be something illegal, and just put them right back in the prison system, because they can't get out of it, because they can't get a job.
You're right. Maybe throw in psychological counseling on the house, too. That's actually a great idea, to have some sort of work program that teaches them skills and is tolerant of some of the holes that are going to exist in their skill set and psychological makeup. Rob, thanks for the call.
You know what's interesting? In all these terrible tragedies, like 9/11 and the Marathon tragedy, mm-hmm. who's the guy, the lawyer that comes in to figures out how much everyone's worth and decides the money that they get?
Oh, the guy that did GM and did the former counsel to Ted Kennedy.
What he does is he figures out, you know, the earning potential of the person. That's right, Feinberg. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. And these are mostly middle-class people who die, you know, innocent people caught in the middle of these horrible situations. But their families do get reasonable compensation.
Ken Feinberg.
But we don't do that for these prisoners, even though we are the ones,
why? Because no one ever believes they're really innocent. Because people say, well, they weren't such great guys anyway. They have a sketchy history. Maybe, as I said before, maybe it was a technicality. And maybe it was, by the way. But read these articles on these hair samples, and if you are not appalled, imagine this happening to somebody you care about or to you. Let's go to Tracy on the Mass Pike. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tracy.
Yes, good morning or good early afternoon.
Whatever it is. Thank you.
First point is that I think this is a compelling argument for why we should not have the death penalty.
You are so right.
Second of all, I'm going to link it to global warming, believe it or not. climate change deniers. I mean, we have senators on the floor of the Senate denying 99% of peer-reviewed research and science to block, common sense precautions and innovation to combat climate change. And it's based on their personal beliefs and convictions, and it seems like, some of this problem is based upon personal beliefs and convictions of prosecutors that are denying science.
Well, yeah, but getting back to global warming, I hope we get this right. I think it was on global warming, climate change. Wasn't it during his State of the Union that Barack Obama recently said, I'm not a scientist? And he paused and he said, but I know a lot of good scientists. And then he went on to say, the guy who's the leader of the pack you're talking about, we talked to Bill McKibben about it last week from 350.org, is the guy Inhofe, who was the chair of the Environment Committee in the Senate. He's the one who said this whole man-made thing is a, quote, hoax. Tracy, thanks for the call. By the way, I would argue, we've heard a million arguments for and against the death penalty since the Tsarnaev trial started on this show and in our community. I think Tracy nailed it. The single most persuasive argument against the death penalty, I think, is the Innocence Project work. When you find out that people have been on death row, possibly executed wrongly, you say to yourself, well, if he or she is serving life in prison without parole, there's a chance not to fix, but to undo some of the injustice. You can't undo it when you've given a lethal injection to Jane Doe or John Doe. So I have to say the moral argument is strong, maybe the money argument, I don't know what, but that argument to me is the most powerful one of them all.
Joe New Bedford.
Joe, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've worked at a jail.
Yep.
Actually in Bristol County.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff cut down all the training programs that would offer there. There was mechanics, there were print shops, there were carpentry shops. And there are some inmates that no matter what you do, you'll never be rehabilitated.
I agree, of course.
They're just corrupt. And they have a long-standing living condition at the jail. But there are a lot of people in there that are there for minor, relatively minor stuff. They're 6 months, maybe a year. And they can lose a lot of skills during that period. And nothing is offered for them to be sustained when they step out. Then the revolving door starts.
Yeah. Well, it's not just people. You have more expertise than I. It's not just people who do 6 months. What's the statistic? 95% of people or some number like that
who
go to jail are going to get out of jail, whether it's 6 months or 10 years or 20 years later. And by the way, you should stay tuned because at about 12:30, we're going to talk to Andrew Cabral, who used to be the sheriff of Suffolk County and the secretary of public safety. One of the things we're going to talk to her about are rehabilitation programs for those who will get out of prison, unlike the Tsarnaevs of the world. Joe, thank you so much for the call.
Coming up, we're going to change gears here. We're going to talk to this unbelievably great underwater photographer, Brian Scarry. He joins us. He's the explorer in residence at the New England Aquarium, and he is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Egan. Brian Scarry is someone who chooses to be face-to-face with sharks, stingrays, and whales. It's something he's been doing for more than 30 years as a marine wildlife photographer. For 15 of those years, you've been seeing his incredible photography in National Geographic magazine. His cover story for the May issue is a focus on dolphin cognition. It's the result of 2 years of field work in 9 locations around the world. Scarry is also the explorer in residence at the New England Aquarium, where he'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7 on his life and work undersea. And to see some of his incredible photography, if you don't know it already, you can go to WGBHnews.org. Brian, it's really a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's great to be here, Jim. And Marjorie, thanks.
Okay, so before you get to the state of the ocean, which is probably not very good, and going face-to-face with these sharks and the squid, apparently, I want to ask you about the photographs that we're talking about now, this dolphin cognition. And they are online, as Jim just said. said, these unbelievably clear photographs you've gotten of these dozens of dolphins like swimming together. Tell us about some of these pictures.
Right. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is I spend a lot of time in the ocean to make these images. On a normal story these days for National Geographic, I might be in the field for about 16 weeks. I try to divide that up over multiple trips to see different behaviors or different locations, different animals, times a year. And, you know, with a normal story these days, shooting digitally, I might shoot 60 or 70,000 pictures. So you're not seeing the bad ones. You're seeing those very special moments when everything sort of comes together.
Sounds like my younger kid on vacation, by the way, 60 or 70. So what does it mean? What is the thing?
Well,
what are you evidencing?
Dolphin cognition.
Cognition,
yeah,
right. So what we wanted to look at with this story was, you know, how smart are dolphins? Or as some of the researchers I was working with actually framed it better, how do we know dolphins are smart? We know that these animals have the second or the biggest brains relative to body size in the animal kingdom, second to humans. But we really don't know that much about how they're using these big brains in the ocean. We know they're highly complex societies. We know that they can use tools. We know that they communicate. You know, for lack of a better analogy, they have a language. But the truth is, because they're in the ocean and we don't see them that often, we don't get to really know that much about them. So this story sort of looked at some of the ways we know dolphins are smart.
Wait a minute. What kind of tools are they using?
Well, believe it or not, they actually, in Australia, they've been identified to pick up sponges and put them on their rostrum, on their nose, to ferret out prey on the bottom. I actually saw a dolphin in captivity, believe it or not, in Key Largo, picking up a blade of grass and sticking it through the fence so that little fish would come over, using it like a fishing lure to attract wild fish outside the fence to come in so he could eat them. I mean, they're very smart.
We're talking to Brian Scurry, and again, you know his photographs, and you can go to WGBHnews.org and check him out. You're a New England kid, right?
I am, yeah. Born and raised in Massachusetts,
so
still live there.
So is that what made you? I mean, you're an ocean guy.
Absolutely.
I've read you a lot. But was it to be a photographer? Was it to be a scientist? I mean, what was the thinking in little Brian Scurry's head?
Well, in little Brian Scurry's head, he wanted to be an explorer. You know, from the earliest memories I have, my parents taking me to the beaches in Cape Cod or Rhode Island, I remember being fascinated by the ocean. So I started scuba diving when I was about 14 or 15 years old. And I then, within a year, attended a diving conference in Boston, the oldest dive show in the world, still going on. They just celebrated their 61st anniversary, the Boston Sea Rover Show. And as a teenager, sitting in the audience watching documentary filmmakers and photographers present their work, I had sort of an epiphany where I said this was the perfect marriage. I could be an explorer of the sea, but do it with a camera. So my goal was to work for National Geographic, but that was a rather lofty dream. You know, there's only two or three guys that had ever at one time been working there. And this little kid from a blue-collar town in Massachusetts had probably a one in a billion chance. But dreams do come true.
You know, when I'm looking at you, this is typical for me. You look like a normal person, I should say.
Well,
I read about some of the circumstances you have found yourself in, and you have a smile on your face. And again, I mean, describe for people who don't know your bio, your history, a couple of the situations you encountered where you were this close to not being around anymore.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, over the years, I've estimated that I've spent probably more than 10,000 hours underwater. And there have been certainly a handful of these dicey moments. I used to do a lot of shipwreck diving. I have a dozen dives on the Andrea Doria and deep German U-boats and so forth. And those were some of the most frightening things, because when you're down 250 feet in the North Atlantic crawling around inside a shipwreck, you know, it can be pretty dicey. But I've had other things. You know, I've sort of been lost for a few moments under polar ice, not being able to find my exit hole. And actually,
how can you say that, like, as a matter-of-fact thing, Brian?
Yeah, how did you find it?
Well, I found another hole, actually. The hole that I had come through, I was photographing harp seals in the Gulf of St. Lawrence under 25-foot thick ice. And you go in the water through these leads, through these cracks in the ice, but they're always moving and shifting with wind and tide. So I had a guy whose job it was to keep an eye on me and the hole, but, you know, that hole closed up, so we had to find another way out.
Wait a minute. So do you just swim around underwater looking for holes?
Well, in theory, we would be able to enter and exit the same hole, and many times that was the case. But sometimes that's not possible. But because it's always moving and shifting, there are other cracks and other ways to get out. I mean, it's not a good plan, but I mean, it does work.
How long did it take you in that situation?
It was just literally a couple of moments, a couple of minutes, but it seems like an hour. You know, your heart's racing. And
the reason you got lost in the Andrea Doria was because it's dark?
I mean, again, that was just very briefly, but I had gone down into the second class dining room area to photograph a new closet that friends of mine had discovered filled with dishes, you know, these second class beautiful Italian painted china. And I made some pictures and then, you know, had to come back out. And I was swimming around a staircase and down a sort of a corridor. And for a moment, you know, you're not sure where you're going. It's all silted out. It's monochromatic. You can't really see very well. And you don't have a lot of time. So, you know, but again, I don't want to overemphasize it. It wasn't that bad.
Okay, well, let's get to this picture that is famous that I've seen before. This is your assistant, I assume, that's with you.
It's a marine biologist.
Okay, marine biologist, who is, you know, right in front of this shark that looks to be a big shark.
Right.
A very big shark. And swimming right toward the assistant, you know, most of us would be like in total Jaws, you know, hysteria.
Yeah.
But he seems to be very calm.
Well,
shark
is.
Looks pretty calm.
Yeah, and you know, sharks are a favorite subject of mine. I absolutely love photographing sharks. In fact, right now I am working on four brand new shark stories for National Geographic that will be published consecutively next year in 2016. And a big reason why I want to do shark photography is to sort of dispel these myths. I mean, they are predators. They are potentially dangerous animals, but they're far more villainized than they really need to be. And the truth of the matter is, today on planet Earth, we're killing in excess of 100 million sharks every single year. And we need predators to keep an ecosystem healthy. And when you consider that every other breath that a human being takes comes from the ocean, the oxygen we breathe, you know, we need sharks. So a lot of my work is to respect these animals, to show them for what they are, but also to show that they have a great value.
Who's killing them?
Well, it's fishing fleets around the world. In many cases, it's for the shark fins, you know, for the shark fin soup in Asia, Hong Kong, places like that. There's been some good positive traction to sort of reduce that, but it's still a very serious problem.
Is there like a little bit of a shark whisperer in you? When I've read some of the things about your relationship to sharks, and I know, and some other creatures that you've done just brilliant work with, do you feel like you can communicate with them? Is there a piece of you that has,
you know,
that in you?
I wouldn't go that far, Jim. I wouldn't say that I feel that I can communicate with them. I do feel that, you know, on any given day, a diver can have a wonderful experience close up with a shark and not be worried about it. But I do respect these animals, and I know that they are potentially dangerous. So whenever I go into the water to photograph them, I, you know, have my guard up. I am a little bit apprehensive. But I also know that, you know, they're not nearly as bad as they've been portrayed.
So is it the solitude? Is it the strength of the ocean? Is it the beauty? Is it the risk? What's the thing that has kept you doing this so masterfully for so long?
I mean, I guess to some degree it's all of those things, but I would say it's the sense of discovery. Uh-huh. You know, that the ocean still remains...
The explorer you wanted to be.
It's still largely unexplored. And as a photographer, it's the perfect place to work. There's no end to the subjects that you can find there, you know?
When you came in, you were talking about the ocean not being in particularly good shape. Mm. Tell us more.
Well, that's true. That is a true statement. I mean, we've got 100 million sharks being killed every year. More than 50% of the coral reefs that once existed in the ocean are gone. They're either seriously degraded or completely gone. We've got ocean acidification. You know, back to the overfishing issue, it's not just sharks. I mean, 90% or somewhere in that vicinity, it's been written, of the big fish in the ocean, the tunas, the sharks, and the billfish have vanished over the last 60 years post-World War II.
Well, how about all right off New England, the bottom fish?
Absolutely.
The cod and
I mean,
that big dispute between the Gloucester fishermen and the NOAA or whatever
It is a serious problem. I mean, I've partnered with the Conservation Law Foundation here in Boston to help bring some visual, you know, acuity to the problem, to show people what's happening out there in New England's oceans. I've dived here my whole life. And when I started diving in the 70s, I used to see big shoals of bait fish, you know, right off the shores in Rockport and Gloucester and those places. And I just don't see that anymore. It's not there. And for that kind of dramatic, you know, loss to have happened in a short amount of time is dramatic.
So it's a combination of overfishing and climate change?
I think, yes, both of those things for sure. You know, I mean, we have gotten very, very good at taking fish out of the ocean. And the reality is today with satellite data and so forth and fishing fleets that have Star Wars, you know, equipment, the fish really don't have a chance. So I think we need more marine protected areas. I think we need more places where the ocean is protected. And we need, you know, obviously wise management. And I think most of the fishermen that I've met would agree with that to some extent, that they think, you know, for their future generations, for their kids to be able to still fish, we need, you know, a sound approach.
Are you optimistic? Bill McKibben was here, who started the whole anti-climate change movement. He was with us last week, wrote The End of Nature. He's optimistic. It seems to be that kind of person, you know, the 400,000 people in the streets in New York City last September around climate change, mostly on ground. Mm. Is there a movement to save, protect, preserve the place where you work?
There is. There's many movements. And I do feel optimistic, and I do see some real traction, as I mentioned, in that regard. You know, I did a story on the value of marine protected areas for National Geographic in 2007. And at that time, less than 1% of the world's oceans were actually protected. Today, you know, it might be somewhere around 2% or something, which isn't much. And we should be probably up around 30 or 40% if you talk to researchers. But the truth is, there's been somewhat of an arms race with countries protecting huge swaths of ocean, particularly in the Pacific. And I think that sort of momentum will continue. People are seeing, you know, there are countries like Kiribati, a small Pacific island nation, that are already experiencing sea level rise, and they're buying land in other places to move their people. So they are sort of taking the lead on these protections.
Brian, we have less than a minute left. Can you tell me a very quick dolphin interaction story?
Yeah, I had a magical moment with spinner dolphins actually in Hawaii. I had heard that they play this game called the leaf game, which other dolphins play in other parts of the world with kelp. But they will pick up a leaf that has drifted into the water and pick it up on their pectoral fin or their dorsal fin or their tail and swim with it and then pass it to another dolphin. And I hadn't actually witnessed that. But after weeks of being in Hawaii and making pictures, I went in one morning off a little bay off the beach, not off a boat, early in the morning, and I actually saw three dolphins playing this game and got a picture for the magazine. So it was pretty magical. They allowed me into their world.
That is so
kind of like passing leaf ball or something
exactly.
Like that.
Wow, that is beautiful.
Brian, it's thrilled to talk to you, and the pictures are just phenomenal. Where's the outro of this? Here, it's
right here.
You can
go to WGBHnews.org to see a lot of the great ones.
Yes, you can. And he's going to be tonight at the New England Aquarium giving a free lecture. What time is the lecture, please?
7 o'clock.
The lecture is at 7, but I've just been told it's sold out. So GBH will be filming it, and we can watch it online.
Terrific.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here, Brian. Coming up, we go inside the ADX Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. It's where Joachar Sarnaev could end up if he is given a life sentence. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH.
We'll kick off the noon hour of today's Boston Public Radio with Mark Benelli. He's the guy who wrote the New York Times Magazine piece on the Supermax prison in Colorado that Tsarnaev will likely be shipped to if the jury decides to spare his life.
Andrew Cabral, the former sheriff of Suffolk County and public safety secretary, with her take on the Supermax, as well as on America's soaring incarceration rate. Michael Norton from Harvard Business School on the so-called IKEA effect. You're going to love this one. Then the wild, crazy, and forever zany local playwright, Gold Dust Orphan, Ryan Landry on his latest bit of brilliance, Thoroughly Muslim Millie. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So it's what a former warden called the clean version of hell. It's where sane men go and become crazy. It's where people sleep chained to concrete beds. It's home to Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, Shoe Bomber, Richard Reed, Oklahoma City conspirator, Terry Nichols, and it could be where Jahar Tsarnaev ends up if he's given a life sentence without parole. We're talking about ADX, the Supermax Penitentiary in Florence, Colorado. Writer Mark Benelli recently wrote a profile of the prison for the New York Times Magazine. It's titled Inside America's Toughest Prison. Mark Benelli is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and the author of Detroit City is the Place to Be. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, first of all, congratulations on an unbelievable piece of reporting. I read this piece and it made me sick to my stomach. I was embarrassed that I didn't know about this. Tell people, you have a lot of profiles of different people. Start with the story of this one inmate you talked a lot about, Jack Powers. Tell people what he was in for and what happened to him.
Sure. Jack Powers, his story is particularly crazy, and that's one of the reasons why I showcased him in the piece. He was a serial bank robber in the late 80s. He was convicted, I believe, of robbing about 30 banks. He never used a gun, always just handed the teller a note. So he ended up in the federal prison system at a penitentiary in Atlanta. There, he befriended an inmate named Eduardo Wong, who was in on a heroin conspiracy charge. They became friends. Shortly after that, Wong got crosswise with the Aryan Brotherhood, which is a very notorious white supremacist prison gang, very violent. They tried to shake him down for money because they believed he had money on the outside. They eventually murdered Wong in front of Jack Powers. Powers testified against the Aryan Brotherhood, those Aryan Brotherhood members, for the state and what he believed would be exchanged for a reduced prison sentence and being kept in protective custody. He contends that the state didn't keep its end of the bargain, that they weren't reducing his sentence. He also, after witnessing this murder, began suffering from severe PTSD. Eventually, he escaped from this lower security prison. He had a son, a young son in Syracuse, New York, who he wanted to visit. He drove up there, visited, tried to find his son, couldn't find him, ended up running into a neighbor and helping her cut the lawn. He stopped at the mall. It was this kind of funny, almost outing that he had. Eventually, he's picked up, and now that he has escaped from a federal prison, he's considered a high security threat. So that's why he ended up at the ADX, the same prison, as you mentioned at the outset, where people like the Unabomber or Eric Rudolph, the Atlanta Olympics bomber, mafia bosses, drug kingpins are all kept. And regular prisoners like Powers end up there if they're considered flight risks or if they're considered especially violent or unruly or just unmanageable. Once he arrived at the ADX, he basically began to lose his mind. It's a prison where people are kept in solitary 23 hours of every day. They're in rooms that are 12 foot by 7 foot. The showers and sinks and toilets, everything is in their room. They get their food delivered to them through this slot in a double set of doors.
What level of human contact is there for these people, Mark?
I'd say extremely minimal. Basically, on average, they get about 10 hours outside of their cell per week. And that either takes the form of going to an indoor gym, I'm making air quotes, in the studio, which is just a room with like a chin-up bar, and they're just in there by themselves. Or they can go to the prison yard, but it's not the sort of prison yard that you're probably imagining from a movie about prisons. Each prisoner is in an individual sort of little cage. So they're out in a yard together, and they can kind of talk to one another by like shouting to the different cages, but there's no real contact.
So what happened to Powers? I interrupted you.
Let's go back to Powers. Tell us about his deterioration.
Well, before he started showing signs of PTSD after witnessing that murder, he'd really had no previous history of mental illness. Once he got to the ADX, it's really an incredible deterioration over about 8 or 9 years. He sliced off both of his earlobes. He severed his Achilles tendon. He smashed holes into the top of his skull and started injecting what he believed was bacteria-laden fluid into his sort of brain cavity. He cut into his own scrotum and removed a testicle. I mean, it goes on, and it's really just horrific. And he would periodically be sent, transferred from the ADX to the medical facility, the federal prisoner medical facility, which is in Springfield, Missouri. And there's a whole paper trail of reports where psychiatrists, you know, prison psychiatrists basically said, you know, he's not insane. He can go back to the ADX. Technically, you know, by the Federal Bureau of Prisons' own rules, you're not supposed to be in a prison like the ADX if you're seriously mentally ill. And he was determined again and again not to be seriously mentally ill, even though he had done this whole list of horrific things to himself that
and
I
how
just
long,
told you.
How long – and you also mentioned in this piece that he, when he gets to the ADX, who's there, lo and behold, but the Aryan Brotherhood, of whom he's obviously petrified after they murdered his friend in front of him. This is the same guy, right? And that made him even more paranoid.
Yeah, the three men
– not paranoid. He was rightfully, I guess, petrified.
Yeah. Three of the men who he testified against were in the same prison in the ADX. And shortly after he arrived, one of them was able to pass him a note saying, "We know you're here. We're going to cut your head off," something like that.
You know, for people who haven't read the piece yet but are just listening to Mark Benelli talk about Jack Powers, it's really important that you not think that this is some aberrational moment. While it's a really dramatic case, you have an endless litany of them. There's this guy, I don't remember his name, who cut his finger off.
David Shelby,
puts it in his ramen soup, eats it. And then is upset, not because he cut his finger off and ate it, but because he'd been a vegetarian for a month, and all of a sudden he's eating meat from a human himself. Isn't that what the story was?
Exactly. I met Shelby. He's no longer in the ADX. He's in a medium security prison in North Carolina, and he's doing much better now because they've got him on the proper medication. But yeah, he told me that story and said he was freaking out because, you know, he summoned the guard, actually, and said, "Officer, you know, I've done something horrible. I ate my finger, and I'm a vegetarian." The guard was shocked. So, but no, it's horrible. And the way I found out about Powers and Shelby was because there's a big lawsuit happening where the Bureau of Prison is being sued in a class action suit by a group of inmates who contend they've been treated improperly because they have serious mental illness there.
Is there an argument, by the way, is this like an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution kind of thing? What are they, or is it smaller than that? I don't know if smaller is the right word. You know what I mean? What's the basis for their complaint?
Well, I think it's the Bureau of Prisons' own rules. I mean, there's a guidebook saying, you know, this is not legal. And so to hold prisoners with these sorts of mental illnesses. And so you had, you know, certain prisoners contending that once they were transferred to the ADX, their prescriptions were changed. So they were no longer on, say, serious anti-schizophrenic drugs, which would classify them as mentally ill enough to not be in the ADX. So if that's true, that's a gross violation of you know, the BOP's own statutes.
Well, there's a very upsetting line in here where you talk about this psychiatrist stopping one inmate's prescription for some bipolar disorder problems, telling, quote, "We don't give out feel-good drugs here." You know, Mark, I get the lawsuit with the patients and the mental illness and saying this violates their own rules. But get back, I mean, you've done the reporting on this. Get back to what Jim is talking about, the cruel, unusual punishment thing. You read this thing and you think, who wouldn't rather be dead, you know, of a lethal injection than to be in this place? And I don't really understand it because I know that these are dangerous people and the guards are worried about violence, et cetera. But this is, as one of the wardens said, analogous to hell.
It's true, and you know, one of the interesting things about this is the idea of the supermax, the idea of an entire prison where basically everyone is in solitary confinement, actually came out of this reform movement. It started back in Philadelphia in the 18th century.
Ben Franklin, how disappointing is that? But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. It was in Ben Franklin's the salon in his apartment. This group of well-meaning Quakers first started reading from these pamphlets calling for what they called, you know, houses of repentance, penitentiaries. And this was seen as a very humane alternative to the public punishments that were happening before then, you know, people being put in the stockades and being publicly humiliated and flogged. And these Quakers thought, you know, if we give people some time to just be by themselves and think about what their, you know, about their sins and repent, they can actually reform. Of course, it didn't work out that way. They did try it. In Philadelphia, they built a prison called Eastern State Penitentiary, which the building still exists. You can visit it. You know, they had these prisoners in solitary, and people even back then were going insane. And it fell out of favor for many decades. By the 1930s, Alcatraz opened, and that was the sort of ADX of its day. That's where they sent the sort of, you know, so-called worst of the worst prisoners, people like Al Capone, people like Whitey Bulger.
Whitey Bulger, exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, it was this island prison considered impossible to escape from. That closed in the 60s when it sort of started to just get older and deteriorate. And those prisoners started to be sent to a penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. And Marion was really eventually became the first all lockdown facility in 1983. And to your question about cruel and unusual punishment, I think it's all about control. That's where it starts, at least. Marion became an all lockdown facility after two members of the Aryan Brotherhood were able to murder two different prison guards.
Yep.
At Marion on the same day. They pulled off this very, you know, highly planned, you know, double assassination in one day. One of those men, incidentally, is now at the ADX, and he's been in solitary for 23 years, a guy named Tommy Silverstein. So, you know, it was this really, this amazing confluence of you know, the fact that lots of mental health facilities had been closed in the United States at the federal and in state level. So you had many more mentally ill prisoners in the prison system. At the same time, you had the whole, you know, prison population booming in general. This is, you know, the 70s, 80s. And so you've got these overcrowded prisons with a much more volatile mix of prisoners, many of them with serious mental illness who are going to be behavioral problems for the guards. And so the solution was not to give these men better treatment or to sort of come up with some other alternative. It was to create supermaxes. The first state supermax, Pelican Bay, opened in 89. And then from there, you know, the ADX opened in 94. And there are now something like 80,000 people in solitary on any given day.
We're talking to Mark Benelli, who wrote a terrific piece last month in New York Times Sunday Magazine entitled Inside America's Toughest Prison. We assume, obviously, one doesn't know, that if the jury in South Boston decides that Tsarnaev should not be executed, that this is where he ends up. That's a pretty safe bet, is it not?
From everything I've heard, yes. I think, you know, there are lots of, you know, as you mentioned at the outset, there are lots of terrorists. At the ADX, the Unabomber, Eric Rudolph, the Olympics bomber, mm-hmm. Terry Nichols, some of the conspirators with, you know, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, as well as the 9/11 attack. So, yes, that would be most likely where he'd end up.
Well, speaking of the Tsarnaev thing, I want to play something for you. The other night on my television show, Greater Boston, I had former U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Don Stern, with me. And I asked him if the jurors in that case will have an opportunity to know when they're deciding is it life or death for Tsarnaev, what, quote, life would be like should he be sentenced to this supermax. Here's what Stern had to say.
Typically, again, you can get testimony about what the defendant has done in prison since his arrest until the day of trial.
But that doesn't help here.
It doesn't help here. The question is, what about going forward? What does the future look like? I think it's unlikely. And by the way, I think it would be a great piece of evidence for the defense to have, because the message they want to give to the jury is, here's an alternative. You know, there's death penalty, and then there's this horror of being in supermax.
So, Mark Benelli, do you have any idea if jurors ever do get to hear this? I mean, Marjorie, I am a lawyer in my former life, but not now. Marjorie's not a lawyer. It seems to us, as lay people, it is so obviously relevant to a jury's consideration. They know what death is like, or they don't know I would assume, unless they've read your piece, what life in prison without parole in a supermax is like. Does that ever get into evidence in these cases where juries are deciding between life and death? Do you know?
I'm not really sure. I would be surprised, just because they're so, the ADX in particular is so secretive. No journalists have been allowed inside since, for at least 10 or 15 years. They denied all requests for a tour, an interview from me. And, they just really don't want people to know what it's like. So unless the defense lawyer somehow, found out independently, I would be surprised.
You know, Mark Benelli, I sound like Pollyanna here, but I find it incredible that the United States of America, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, could keep the public via journalists who can report on these things out of a place like this. We have a case here in Boston where a guy that was a politician who did do something bad, took $60,000,
Former
Speaker of the House, is in the federal prison system now. He's very ill with cancer. He could be in Boston where he could see his family. Instead, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, against the wishes of the judges, the judge in the case, sent him off to, where is Zelda Macy
Kentucky
now?
Kentucky or somewhere.
Somewhere down south. But the point is, and I get why this is not a very sympathetic crew in here, so a lot of people would say, I don't care what happens to Zhohar Tsarnaev. On the other hand, there's something outrageous in terms of, government secrecy that and tax dollars obviously supporting this, that they can do all this in secrecy. And I just wonder, is there any kind of – I mean, I know there's this lawsuit and your great reporting and the story about this lawsuit and the story about these inmates. But is anybody worked up to a frenzy about this besides the typical
– Like in Congress,
prisoners' rights groups or – is anybody else taking up the cause here?
Well, it does seem to be a sort of moment happening over the last couple of years, not specifically only about the ADX, but about the overuse of solitary confinement in general. Dick Durbin, the senator, held the first Senate hearings on the overuse of solitary a couple of years ago. There was lots of testimony, including a psychiatrist named Craig Haney, who was one of the original researchers on the Stanford Prison Experiment back in the 70s when he was in graduate school. And he testified very compellingly about what extended periods of time in solitary can just do to your mind. And then things like this lawsuit really there's another lawsuit happening at Pelican Bay as well. That's one way to bring these stories to the surface, because even though these prisons can keep journalists out, they can't keep lawyers out. So Ed Arrow, one of the main lawyers who I interviewed, who is behind this lawsuit, was able to visit the ADX with the psychiatrist. They interviewed about 70 prisoners, and she found that a large percentage of them would fall under the category of seriously mentally ill.
You know, I'm trying to think about what the other side of this is, other than, as Marjorie said, this is not exactly a sympathetic crew of people to whom you want to run to the defense. Is part of the argument that why we have to keep them in solitary is because they have done the most unimaginable things, like Zhohar Tsarnaev. And I think the word you might have used in your piece is there's no disincentive for them to not do more horrible things, like to guards or other prisoners. Is that their defense, if there is a defense, of this 23-hour-a-day lockdown? Is that what the prison officials say?
Yeah, I think they would say that about a lot of the inmates. For instance, these Aryan Brotherhood guys, if you're already serving life without parole for murder, you don't have an incentive to not try to kill a guard if you're that sort of psychotic inmate, right? So they're men like that. But a lot of them are also just displaying symptoms of mental illness.
Are any of them not displaying symptoms? I mean, the thing I can't imagine, I mean, it wasn't Colorado, I think you wrote about this, the guy where the former head of the State Bureau of Prisons put himself in solitary for a day and then started campaigning against solitary confinement. Do I have that right or do I not have that right?
No, you have it right. And his predecessor had really been the first to start openly campaigning against solitary. And then he's Tom Clements. He was the one who was murdered by
a
former inmate who'd spent a considerable amount of time in solitary.
So who is not seriously mentally ill after – I don't mean this is a facetious comment. Who is not seriously mentally ill after a time, even if you weren't mentally ill coming in, after being locked up by yourself with virtually no human contact for 23 hours a day?
Right. That's a great question. I don't know. I guess there are probably very technical – definitions of mental illness. I mean, one of the former inmates who I interviewed, the man who you referred to, who was on the bipolar medication and who said they took him off the medication because they don't, quote, give out feel-good meds. He is out of the ADX now and is living in the Washington, D.C. area. And, you know, he's somebody who I would consider pretty seriously mentally ill. He tried to commit suicide for the first time when he was like 8 years old, I believe. He drank a bottle of bleach, he said. Mm. He, you know, cuts himself, has made multiple suicide attempts over the years. But he, you know, by his own admission, coped much better than in the ADX than lots of the other men there. So there, it's really, you're talking about degrees.
Sure.
And, you know, two last things for me, Mark Benelli. Number one, I'm not an expert on prisons, but just having been a reporter all my life, I've been to some state prisons. And there's a lot of murderers and bad actors and Aryan Nation type people in state prisons, too. But they have kind of a reward system, you know, where you do certain things, you get a better deal, you get better time. We used to have in Massachusetts, it's unbelievable, murderers could get furloughs for the weekends. But that ended with the notorious Willie Horton case when Michael Dukakis was running for president a million years ago. But in any case, so you say to yourself, well, they're murderers in federal prison. They're murderers in state prison. They don't do this in state prison. And yet, I mean, there are some attacks on guards, we know. But for the most part, it doesn't happen. So I guess I don't understand why there's this attitude at these supermaxes when at Walpole State Prison or whatever we're calling it these days. I forget the name of it now, the state prison here. You know, you're in solitary if you misbehave. You know what I mean?
Exactly. You know, I interviewed in the piece one of the former warden at the ADX, a guy named Bob Hood, and he's the one that
said it a clean version of hell. Isn't that the guy who said that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a lifelong – I mean, he's retired now, but he was a lifelong prison warden, definitely not a bleeding heart liberal. But even he, you know, and the ADX, being warden of the ADX was his last assignment, an assignment he requested. He liked the idea of the challenge. And he was, you know, struck over his time there about, you know, I guess partly, you know, to your point, how little control he had. He couldn't really, you know, he would tell the inmates, look, this place, I'm paraphrasing, but barely, this place is not designed for humanity. This is not about rehabilitation. And there were certain things he could give them. He could let them have more privileges as far as visitors and things like that. But it was there, you know, there's very little he could do. And he really thinks, you know, he says at the end of the piece, I could reduce the population of the ADX significantly. Not all of the, you know, a large percentage of those men don't need to be in solitary for that period of time. And, you know, he said, I don't care if Sammy the Bull and Robert Hansen, the notorious FBI spy, are out in the prison yard playing ping pong. You know, he said the general public might not like that, but for me as a warden, it makes my life easier when you have some sort of rewards to give people.
And one last quick thing: the cells you described, they have the sinks and the toilets are all in there, and the showers and all that kind of stuff. But they have these little teeny tiny windows that are about what, 3 or 4 inches wide, so you can see like a little tiny piece of the hallway or the outside, correct? And they have concrete slabs they sleep on. What can they have in there besides that? In terms of books, reading material, radios, that kind of thing?
Depending on, you know, the prisoner, a lot of them have these televisions with built-in radios inside, and there's sort of limited channels. And you can get books and sort of some certain prison materials from the library, some arts and crafts materials. And yes, the window is 3 feet high by 4 inches wide, so it's this kind of strange slit, and you can just see this piece of sky, but you know, nothing else really. There's a double set of doors. So there's a solid door, you know, facing the hallway. And then there's a more traditional looking barred prison door on the inside. So you can't even really, you know, kind of shout out to other prisoners across the hall or anything like that.
Yeah.
And other than that, no, there's not much, you know, to do except pace your 12-foot by 7-foot cell.
Let me tell you, if Jahar Sarnaai have read this piece, I think he'd turn to Judy Clark and say, let him
kill me. Now.
Really.
Kill me now. Absolutely.
Mark Benelli, terrific piece. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations again. It's an incredible and very upsetting piece. Mark Benelli is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, the author of Detroit City is the Place to Be. His recent piece on the ADX for the New York Times Magazine is called Inside America's Toughest Prison. Coming up, We're going to talk to somebody who knows a lot about the criminal justice system. That's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety, Andrea Cabral. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for her inaugural open mic on Boston Public Radio is Andrea Cabral. Andrea is the former Suffolk County Sheriff. She's the former Public Safety Secretary under Deval Patrick and current authority on the criminal justice system. Andrea Cabral, great to see you. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Boy, I'm dying to talk to you. I've been thinking about you for days, ever since I started reading about these supermax prisons, because I was in your prison in Suffolk County when you were with the sheriff, and it was nothing like this, let me tell you. But, I mean, you are the former public safety person. You were a sheriff. What do you make of this, the report we just heard about this facility in Colorado? I'm sort of sick to my stomach.
Well, I've known, most people who've worked in corrections have known for years that there are there are supermax prisons. The federal Bureau of Prisons operates differently than the state Bureau of Prisons does. But essentially, although parts of this article would indicate otherwise, essentially they are places for people where there's literally nothing else the system can do for these people, either by the nature of their of a singular crime, the heinousness of a singular crime, or such a great deal of criminal activity over the years with attempts at rehabilitation that it doesn't work. So, but, you know, in reading, I read the article. It was very, very well written. And there does seem to be some indication that people are getting classified there whose conduct doesn't, the criminal conduct does not necessarily seem to merit it. And even if it does initially, it would seem that extended periods of time at that facility are not warranted by the person's conduct or mental state.
Well, even if it turns out, Andrew Kerber, let's assume for argument's sake that I don't know this to be the case, but at least some of the high-profile prisoners there, all the high-profile prisoners whom I know, are ones who aren't ever getting out.
Right,
So there's just not an issue of recidivism because they're not going to be out to commit a crime again, and they've done the worst of the worst. If Tsarnaev ends up there, same deal.
Right.
But it's – I want to be careful. I'm not showing any sympathy for what they did. It's torture. I mean, I know it's a term of art, torture, but the way he described this, 23 hours in some cases, what was that one guy, 23 years in solitary confinement, 23 hours, the 10 hours a week that they're allowed out, for the most part, there's virtually no human human conduct. They have a 3-inch slit in their wall that allows them to see the sky outside. I mean, what theory of imprisonment or incarceration is that an example of, except torture?
Well, the physical plant of the cell and the ability to sort of look out onto the world with which you have no contact, notwithstanding, I would say a lot of the people there, the fear is that their continued contact with other people presents a danger to those people and even presents a danger to the people who work there. There is absolutely a portion of the population that should be kept away from all other people. That said, there were people highlighted in that article, and the gentleman who wrote it seemed to have researched it really well. I don't think he left anything out about their background, who would not need that. And I agree with you. The when you talk about mental illness and the correction system, not only are there a lot of people involved in the correctional system who have mental illness that is trauma-based, that is based on things that have happened to them or that it gets exacerbated over time with repeated incarcerations. So you definitely have that. This type of incarceration for someone who ought not necessarily to be there is really going to exacerbate any mental illness that they have. I mean, you literally are driven crazy by the fact that you are alone all the time. Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I don't understand, and you were the sheriff, so I hope you can help me, is say Terry Nichols, accomplice mm-hmm. in the Oklahoma City bombing, which everybody knows, 158, 159 people killed, all those little babies at the daycare center, horrible. But he's been there now for quite some time. And he did. I'm not, again, saying he's a nice guy. He's obviously not. But I'm not clear why he has to be in a cell 23 hours a day. I mean, why there can't be something a little bit more like you see in state prisons, and correct me if I'm wrong, with sort of you win points for certain things and you get better privileges for good behavior. So to try to, you know, so you're not going to kill the guard.
And you lose him for bad behavior.
You know, I don't – why does he need to be in this situation until he's dead?
I think that we consistently discount the concept of punishment and – what we use it for and why we use it. I mean, to a great degree, I think that it is absolutely related to the act that you've committed. So you were not sentenced to death. I mean, the theory of the death penalty anyway is that you relinquish your right to live by virtue of the heinousness,
right,
which usually involves the murder of others, of your conduct. So if you are spared that and it's life without the possibility of parole in prison, I think it is more directly related to punishment because there's no need to think about rehabilitation. And I'm saying this as what I think the theory of it is that there's no sense in devoting resources to anything other than punishment because this person is never going to get out. So why would you even bother? And we don't have a conversation about why we punish and how we punish.
But I guess to me, this, in a layperson, this looks like a constitutional violation of cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, I think we all understand that, you know, you shouldn't have a wonderful time in prison. But this is not – this seems to be the other extreme, you know, where you have zero contact and you're driven insane.
Well, I think that that's exactly the kind of case that someone would bring to a federal court and would ultimately probably go up to the Supreme Judicial Court. But based on some of their past rulings, I would say they are not likely to find this to be cruel and unusual punishment. I'm thinking about a specific case and a specific reference by Justice Thomas, something that I thought on the face of it would be considered cruel and unusual, and they decided
that it
wasn't.
What was the case? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name of the case. I remember it was about the treatment of the individual, and he didn't think it shocked the conscience of the court.
I remember his comments on that case. Do you remember his comments during the oral argument?
No.
Well, he doesn't make any
Jim
comments.
Right. He doesn't. Right.
Exactly.
He never says anything.
Spoken once in 10 years,
that's right.
I know.
Right.
You know, let's bring this back to Massachusetts. Mark Brunelli said there are roughly 80,000 prisoners in America in solitary confinement. I think there are two maximum security prisons in Massachusetts, Cedar Junction and Walpole and Susa Baranowski and Lancaster. I'm right about that. How many people roughly from your, as best you know from your time as Secretary of Public Safety, how many people at any one time in solitary confinement in Massachusetts, and what is solitary confinement like here as compared to what we just heard described in the Supermax in Colorado?
It's a sort of a revolving number.
Sure.
I don't know how many there are at any one given time. There are always people sort of going in and going out.
But could there be hundreds at a time? If there are 80,000 nationally, I assume that's not...
I don't think there would be hundreds
okay.
in Massachusetts. I think that would be a little high.
And what kind of conditions do they live under?
Single cell conditions and recreation, I think. There are so many hours a week that you're entitled to recreation, and depending on what you've done, you can be wrecked, I think, with others. In some cases, people are wrecked alone because alone because their behavior is so violent. And you essentially have virtually no privileges except what is, constitutionally mandated in terms of outside recreation.
But are they mostly, since you said revolving
Andrew it's a Cabral. Punishment here.
It's mostly a temporary state.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not like you're going to spend 23 years in solitary confinement at Cedar Junction. That's
no.
not what happens here.
No.
So let's get away then. Let's just talk about confinement in Massachusetts beyond the worst of the worst. You know, for the average prisoner, whoever
right.
here she is. I know when you were working for Deval Patrick, he made some progress on things like mandatory minimums, which obviously are increasing prison population, that's that sort of thing. What's the philosophy that governs? I know I talked to you in the old days when you were a sheriff of Suffolk County about rehabilitation and training, particularly of young women, preparing them for the outside. What percentage of people get out? Like 95% or?
95%.
95% of people who go
at
in
least,
who
yeah.
don't either die or have life without parole get out. What percentage are recidivists for the most part?
That's actually what we're in the middle of measuring.
Roughly.
Using this new tool.
But
well,
60, something like that, 70?
In 2006, it was something like 66%. Okay. I'd wager that in 2015 that has dropped dramatically, in large part because of all of the programming and all of the attention on rehabilitation in the ensuing
years.
Well,
what is that? That's the question. What do we do with that prisoner who's getting out for the most part? I know there's no typical prisoner, but in Massachusetts, with the create a typical prisoner, it, you know, either that you had when you were the sheriff or anywhere, give us just a sense, if you can, of what life is like and how we prepare them for life when they return to our neighborhoods.
Well, what the DOC has now, and this was put together in my last 2 years as secretary under Governor Patrick, what the DOC has now is a far more seamless reentry system because they work in concert with the county sheriffs. So the county sheriffs operate the houses of correction. And the sheriffs have, since 2001, have been doing reentry programming in order to prepare people appropriately to reenter the community.
What's that, like job skills?
Oh, it's
train. What is it exactly?
It actually runs the gamut from education-based programs to job skills programs, getting people back onto MassHealth who've been taken off of MassHealth so that they begin to understand the need for continuing mental health care and medical care, to finding jobs, to actually finding jobs for people with employers who will hire people who have criminal records. And there's a great deal of counseling involved, and it's an entire system. Well, the DOC, because their facilities are in different parts of the state, had a harder time with reentry because the local services are not going to go all the way out to Shirley, and it's difficult to connect. But if you're from Dorchester, what are you going to connect with in Shirley that's going to help you once you get out? So now inmates are stepped down. With 2 years or less left on their sentences, they're stepped down into the sheriff's program. So there's a state-to-county step-down system. They should be receiving some reentry programming while they're still in the DOC leading up to that. We changed the classification system so that there are fewer people in medium security now, where there are fewer programs, and more people in minimum security, so that they're prepared to step down into the sheriff's programs. So you have to create a system. That reward versus punishment system you alluded to, that's behavior-based, the natural continuum of that is to continue to step people down into lower and lower security classifications and then step them out at a point at which they're coming from a halfway house back into the community, or even if they're leaving a house of correction and going back into the community, they've been prepared to go into that world, seek a job, be a better parent, hopefully with a little more understanding of their conduct and the impact that it has generationally and on their families and generationally. That's what, I mean, there really was, under Governor Patrick, really a real serious movement toward creating the system.
So, you don't have the numbers yet. The point you made a minute ago is you're convinced that these kinds of programs are not only the right thing to do, but are going to cause that 66% number of whatever year you said, 2005 or 6, to be dramatically lower. That's the whole point.
And that's a national trend. That is not just in Massachusetts. The trend is whether you believe in saving money, and that's why you want to do it, because it's unsustainable in the state where you live right now to continue to pay for it, or you believe in a more socially acceptable outcome of rehabilitation. The movement across the country is recognition of the over-incarceration of people.
Hey, by the way, in tough-on-crime states, by the way, the Texases of the world are leading the charge on some of these things, and we're actually in some ways behind, aren't we?
We have the same – we're using the same Pew first results first model as Texas uses. We're considered a Pew state, and actually we're considered a very good Pew state because we put this cost-benefit analysis model into place. That's why I gave you the 2006 number, because when we started using this model, we used a baseline of 2006 data from DYS, DOC, the sheriffs, probation, and parole, so that we were on the same page in terms of recidivism. And that's why we got that baseline number in 2006. And you continue to measure out to make sure that the dollars you're spending for those programs, you're getting a bang for that buck in terms of how long people stay or keep from reoffending.
That's the voice of Andrew Cabral, former Secretary of Public Safety, former sheriff of Suffolk County.
I know you were at the Suffolk County lockup. You weren't at the Cedar Junction or Walpole, as people often call it, or Susan Baranowski up in Shirley. But I wonder if you know, Andrew Cabral, if you are in the general population, those are the two maximum security prisons in the state, what is life like there if you're in the general population? Because a lot of the people that are there are murderers who aren't going to get out either, but they're not in solitary. So what are they doing up there?
As well as is safe, they're integrated in the general population. I mean, there are, you know, the the notion of murder and who kills, as heinous as it is sort of particular. And quite frankly, unless a person is killing in a sort of a serial fashion as part of a gang, lots of people who've murdered people, that will be the one person in their life that they ever kill, and they right. don't intend to repeat that conduct. And in some ways, at least to my observation, they're, despite what they've done, and I'm not making any excuses for it, they are less dangerous than people who are serially violent and right. are serial batterers, or, you know, even serial committers of other kinds of crimes. So, a prison population is a real sort of goulash of different types of people. And the system works as hard as it can within the context of being a system. To keep people integrated with the notion that 95% will get out. I mean, the percentage of people who are serving life without the possibility of parole is fractional compared to the other population. So people have got to get along one way or the other. For those that can't, for over, you know, lengths of time, they are punished internally. They don't get parole. You know, their institutional behavior is made known to the parole board when they go up, and they get sent back, and they don't get a good decision from the parole board. But for the vast majority of people, unless you're looking at what's going to happen when they get closer in time to get out, you're not running a good system.
Yeah, Andrea Cabral, who's the, you know, I'm imagining, I used to lobby at the State House, and I use the term very loosely, lobby in my case. So when you had to lobby legislators for Deval Patrick's prison reform, I'm saying to myself, what constituency is this for this? I mean, in a lot, it's fine to have a discussion in the abstract like we're doing here, but you're talking to a legislator saying, excuse me, that guy just raped three women. Excuse me, that woman shot the father of her children with her little four-year-old watching. And I assume the ghost of Willie Horton continues to hang over. I mean, Willie Horton, I'm sure people out there know, Willie Horton was a convicted murderer, let out on a furlough program. And after, what does he tie up the husband or the boyfriend? He rapes the woman. And it was under Mike Dukakis' furlough program. And then, by the way, most people think George Bush started. It was actually Al Gore who used it in the primary against Mike Dukakis. And it stayed with him. What case do you, it seems to me the only thing they'd really care about, I hate to disparage the whole group, is it going to save us money? Is that, what else do they care about?
Some care about whether or not it's going to save us money. There are people who actually just care about more general efficiency in government, and there are people who genuinely care about that population. But in terms of having a constituency per se, there is none. There, one could make the argument that there is a hidden constituency, given the, because most of the people that we incarcerate don't fall into the categories that you just mentioned. Most of the people that we incarcerate are not the person who shot a
drug
woman and two kids.
And that
right.
sort of stuff, right.
We have a huge percentage of that population is in for the types of crimes for which you would serve time at a house of correction. Mm. And then because you've worn out your welcome at the house of correction, you end up in state prison for longer and longer periods of time.
By misbehaving, you've worn out your welcome.
No, by continuing to do the same things over and over again.
Repeat offenders.
A judge will look at your record and say, you've already done time in the house of correction. Now you're going to state prison. But I don't think that there isn't a constituency per se, but there seems to be, because I can just tell from when I first started as sheriff in 2002 to now, a growing awareness of both the unsustainability and, in some respects, the unseemliness of incarcerating as many people as possible. So to the extent that, you know, solutions are placed before the legislature that are both cost-effective and you can make the argument that people will may fare better and not reoffend, those arguments have been increasingly more welcome than they were when I first started.
You know, on that front, by the way, just let me give you one statistic. Wes Lowery, who now is with the Washington Post, great reporter for the Globe, again, who's gone. He's with us a couple of months ago after he was in Ferguson. He's commenting on a report in 2013 by Mass Inc. Despite steeply declining violent crime rates, the percentage of mass residents behind bars has tripled in Massachusetts since the 1980s. And by the way, I know you were not there for the 99% of that, but that is just staggering. And the fact that people's eyes are not opened about, I mean, legislators, elected, the disconnect between, wait, violent crime is going down and our prison population is tripling. There's something's wrong with this picture.
Right. Well, also, a lot of the women that are in prison didn't commit any violent crimes. They're in there for drugs, prostitution, bad checks, that kind of thing. I mean, a lot of the women that your former house correction were nonviolent.
Yeah, that's less so now. Yep. What the trend has been with the women sort of increasing involvements in gang activity and violent activity. But yes, historically, and even to some extent now, the crimes tend to be more self-destructive than proactively or externally destructive.
So I know you're not the czarina here, but what do you suspect Aaron Hernandez's situation is going to be? He, of course, is an England patriot that was just convicted of first-degree murder, life without parole, facing two other crimes, but he's probably going to wind up at Sousa Baranowski sooner rather than later. Will he be segregated because he's famous?
They'll make a risk assessment as to whether or not they think, by virtue of who he is, that he is more likely to be a target. And if they make that assessment and decide that he is, so that he's in some sort of protective custody, they'll assess that on an ongoing basis until they feel it doesn't exist anymore. He may not even be assessed to be a target, but they will be looking at that just because he is someone of some notoriety.
But you would expect eventually, I mean,
that he might 10 be in
years
the general
from now,
population.
15 years from now.
Yeah, everyone gets used to everything in prison. So, you know, if that is the case,
Supermax in Colorado. I know you don't mean that. I've never heard anything like that in my life. You know, Andrea, Marjorie just said a minute ago, you're not the czarina. Can I make you the czarina for 1 minute?
Sure, go right ahead.
Give us the
even
one.
You're not paying me.
Give us the one one reform that if the legislator said we'll implement whatever you want done. One reform. Is it more Corey criminal records reform? Is it mandatory minimum sentences? What would help alleviate unfairness, unnecessary expense? What's the one reform that you guys have been pushing for that you didn't get, at least in the fashion you wanted, that would really make a difference? Is there one or two or whatever?
Corey reform has done really well. The reform of that system and how we've kept, I think in our last count, it was over 27,000 records that would have been made available to employers and others that were unnecessary, that didn't tell you anything about this person other than it wasn't a conviction.
So they're shielded. Not they're from shielded, the cops, right. We should say. The cops get access to everything.
Right, absolutely. Law enforcement has access to everything. But the fact that there were over 27,000 cases in 1 year where people got a better opportunity to do better with their lives is very significant.
So what more would you want to do with Corey?
I think mandatory minimum sentencing. I agree with Chief Justice Gantz. I agree and I was for mandatory minimums as a prosecutor. I hated the revolving door of people coming in charged with selling drugs. People's kids couldn't play at playgrounds.
So what happened to you? Why'd you have the epiphany?
Because there's a difference between an idea like mandatory minimums in theory and in practice. And in practice, people are involved. The theory of it would work beautifully if you said, what if we could make people accountable and make sure that it acted as a deterrent because they knew that they would get a minimum sentence and that would deter people from doing it. And, you know, but that's not actually what happens. And in fact, you control how many pleas you can get by how many people are charged with mandatory minimum crimes. So a person will plead to less than a year
because that thing
or no time at all because it's more desirable. And if you don't have things like, if you don't have reentry programs, and that's what I'd say the other part of it is, we need to become an evidence-based criminal justice system. Our decision should be driven by what the data and the science tell us works in terms of programming and everything else, and our funding decisions should follow that. There's no more investing in things that don't work, and we can prove what works and what doesn't. It's stupid to ignore that.
You know, Andy Cabral, I have one more question about the Supermax out in Colorado, which so upset me. You know, it's not just the people that are there that are living these horrible lives. The people that are employed there have got to be living horrible lives because you are in a facility all day that's treating people so inhumanely. It seems to me the guards, after a couple of years, would be almost as whacked as the prisoners.
Although I would not necessarily have phrased it that way. that isn't actually an excellent point and one that I
is
think
or
about.
Isn't.
It is. The one that I think of a lot, mostly because when we started dealing with the issues that were present at Bridgewater, the recognition that the people who have the custody of the people who are the most severely mentally ill, as that's essentially by and large who's at Bridgewater, and most violent, who display the most kinds of bizarre behaviors. You have to take into consideration the impact of doing that every single day on the officer who's having to deal with that. And one of the ways that we addressed that was by having a training that, in fact, staff got very involved and engaged in and actually created. It was almost a train-the-trainer situation and created their own training around it that was designed to build more empathy and more understanding about mental illness so that you understand why this person is doing what they're doing. In other words, if someone is going to act out tremendously because they want to listen to a radio after hours when they're not supposed to be listening to a radio, if you build an understanding of why they're doing that, there might be a way that the system can allow that person to have that radio for just a few minutes because that's a way to de-escalate it. But if you don't understand why the person's acting out, like you say no a million times a day in a correctional setting, the no to someone who's very mentally ill is heard very differently than the no to someone who maybe doesn't suffer from that. But you may get a reaction that's way over the top. You have to increase and pay attention to the people who are actually doing this work and help them to understand better the population that they're dealing with. Now, in a Supermax situation, they're not paying much attention to the mental illnesses. And it's ironic because we execute people in this country and we will actually force them to take drugs to make them less or not mentally ill because we don't kill mentally ill people, but you won't give people psychotropic medication inside of a federal institution because you don't do feel-good drugs. There are lots of things that I just find incongruous, but in any event, I would think that working at the Supermax must have a deleterious impact on the people who work there as well. So even if you don't care about the people who are serving time, you should at least care about the people who are working there and try to build some work situation for them that's not going to be as big a toll on them as I would think this would.
You know, when you come back next week, we're not going to discuss prisons all the time with you, but one thing that's left
hanging
here.
Thank you very much.
The one thing we
because I'm now deeply depressed. Yeah,
we should be a little lighter. Maybe we'll talk about the circus or something next time.
With the movement to close the mental hospitals in Massachusetts in years gone by, I mean, the prisons in the state have become the de facto mental hospitals.
They absolutely are.
We'll save that for next week, and then we'll move on to lighter, frothy kind of things. Andrew Cabral, great to see you.
That's good to see you, too.
Hear what he said? Next time, frothy things, Andrew Cabral. Frothy things. Andrew Cabral is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Public Safety Secretary. Thank you so much for coming in and for dealing with this tough stuff. Coming up, the IKEA effect. How some assembly required can equal love. Behavioral economist Michael Norton joins us for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Everybody knows the phrase, you break it, you own it. What about you build it, you love it? The notion of loving that bookcase that you assembled or the entertainment center you labored over is known as the IKEA effect. It's a term of such universal appeal that IKEA effect, this is true, even has its own Wikipedia entry. Here with us in Studio 3 is the man behind the IKEA effect, behavioral economist Michael Norton. Michael is a professor at the Harvard Business School, the author of Happy Money, The Science Behind Happier Spending. Hey, Michael.
Hey there.
Well, first of all, I had no idea that right next to me in the studio all these weeks has been the man behind the term, the IKEA effect, which is so exciting. But tell people, for people who don't know, what, please, the IKEA effect is.
The idea, actually, for this research came from this notion that almost everyone has something in their house that is terrible looking, and you wonder why it's there, and then you find out that they made it. And I have one, too. Almost nearly everyone has a bookshelf that they built or a mug that they made or something that they put their time and energy into. And if you don't have one yourself, usually your partner or spouse has one that they insist on lugging with you everywhere you go. And you got to bubble wrap it and very carefully pack it. And the mug has a hole and it doesn't work, you know. But we have these things and they're very important to us. And we thought it happens a little bit with IKEA furniture, too, where you put it together yourself, you labor over it for hours. It's not that you think it's the greatest thing in the world, but you like it more than you would have if you didn't put yourself into it. We called it the IKEA effect because it's so common, it seems, in everyday life.
So tell us some of the research you did, some of the experiments you did to prove your point, Michael Norton.
So as always, we try to entertain ourselves as much as possible in the research. So we had – one of our favorite ones was we had grown-ups fold origami. And we had them, you know, make a little crane or a frog. And origami done well, of course, is beautiful, really a lovely art form. I don't know if you've tried it yourself. It usually doesn't go that well amateurs try it.
Right.
But that's what we had people do. So we had some people, we had beautiful origami that we actually sold. We said, how much would you pay for this? We had really lovely cranes and frogs. People said, well, I'll give you about a quarter for that. You know, it's just paper. Other people, we had them fold it themselves. And I can tell you, I wish you could see pictures of these things. They don't look like anything. It's like a crumpled paper with a leg hanging off of it. And we said, how much will you pay us to take that home with you? They said a quarter again. So in their minds, that we call instant experts. My thing that I made is just as good as the beautiful thing that an origami expert made. But the mean thing we did was, before I let you take yours home, the one you bought, I show it to someone else and say, hey, how much would you pay for this? And they say about a nickel. And some of them basically say, I only said a nickel because I didn't want the guy to feel bad. You know, it's crumpled up paper. So we just see this really big change in the value of things if I make it myself compared to what you think it's worth.
Well, didn't you actually do it with furniture construction? And construction or making maybe too strong a word. I've done a million things from IKEA. And Marjorie and I will tell you how we have apparently a different approach to this IKEA effect thing. Didn't do something where someone built a piece of furniture and then you ask them, well, how much is that worth versus the thing fully assembled? Obviously assembled better, but even if weren't fully assembled and they put more value on the thing that they put together over 3 days at their house, is that not true?
So we tried to pick them. So one thing about making origami or a mug, you could say, well, maybe you designed it in a way.
Exactly.
And it reflects your personality. You pick the glaze or who knows what it might be. So we thought, let's pick a really boring product where you really can't imbue it with your own quirkiness. We had people build IKEA CD storage cases. And the reason we picked those is because there's no such thing as CDs anymore. So it was the most useless product we could think of. So why would you be attached to your CD case from IKEA? But you're right. We saw the exact same thing when people – and they're very boring. It's just a very utilitarian product. Even on those, when people put it together themselves, they say, this thing's pretty terrific. But the one that's already made, they say – what the heck would I need a CD case for? I don't have any CDs anymore.
That is hysterical. Just unbelievable.
Now, I wonder if there is a male-female thing here, because I was telling Jim before, I got a bureau for one of my kids from IKEA, and the drawer is never closed right, and I really found it usually annoying, and so did she, and I ended up scrapping it and getting one from one of these secondhand places that was nice, sturdy maple and stuff like that. I couldn't wait to get rid of this bureau because I thought it was just...
Yeah, but tell the other half of the story. What was my side?
Well, you were like...
I have constructed the same thing, and I'm not exaggerating to make a point. I have often laid out all the pieces in these crappy things from IKEA. I've spent a week of my life, either weekend days, whatever, the level of – and by the way, the drawers never work perfectly. Mm-hmm. And just as Marjorie said, the level of satisfaction I feel at the completion of this – I'm not kidding, Michael. I'm not saying this for your effect – is so extraordinary. I can feel it in my body now as I'm describing it to you. I know it's going to fall apart. I know it isn't perfectly balanced. It is so. Is there a male female divide here, or what's the deal?
We haven't tended to see it. I think so. One of the important things is it's not even necessarily that you will think that the thing you put together is the very best thing in the world. So you might have understood your bookcase wasn't the best one, but you might still like it better than if you saw that same exact one that somebody else made.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So you're a little more when the thing you made isn't terrific, which happens to a lot of us. Still, you kind of are more attached to it than if somebody else gave you that built exactly like that.
See, let me tell you another variable. I don't know if you tested my theory on this long before I knew that you had anything to do with the IKEA effect. My theory was that the vast majority of us don't make anything anymore. Essentially, we push paper. We talk, as in the case of Marjorie and me. We teach, as in the case of you. There's no tangible product of our world. Well, you write a column. There's a tangible product to that. But that one of the joys of this kind of making, and I use the term really loosely because we're not really making anything. We're just assembling it, is that there's a tangible thing at the end. At the end, you get to see the product of your work as opposed to us every day. At 2 o'clock, it's sort of on some website, but it's gone. Is there something to that or no?
Yeah, they're really. In fact, when we look to see, of course, we have people fill out surveys about the experience. We ask them a lot of questions. And it really turns out that it is funny that in everyday life, we don't really have a lot of evidence that we did anything.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
At the end of the day, you talk to some people, you send some emails. You know, we didn't do anything all day, all week, all month, all year. You know, it's very hard to look back and say, what the heck did I do last week in a lot of jobs now? And it is the case that people do feel – one of the things that predicts the size of the IKEA effect is I did something. and I can see it and hold it and touch it, and it really is a big part of why it's so powerfully emotional for many people when they make things themselves.
Okay, here's one I totally related to, because I used to make a lot of cakes when my kids were little. They talk about when instant cakes were first introduced in the 1950s to simplify life, they weren't very popular. And then, and it's so true, all they did was say, okay, you add an egg. And suddenly, just adding that egg changed everyone's perspective. And the thing with me is I made a lot of cakes from cake mixes, but and I would buy that frosting in the can. However, to the frosting, I would add confectioner's sugar and sour cream to make the frosting taste really good instead of horrible like it came out of a can. And I would think, you know, even though these were store-bought cakes, as we say, I took an immense amount of – I thought my cakes were just amazing. And even though, because all I'd done was add the egg and add the water and the mix and then add the sour cream and confectioner's sugar. So it's not IKEA, but it's the same thing.
It absolutely is. And it turns out that there's a line at which we feel as though we made something ourselves or not. And we can figure out what that line is. It varies from product to product. But like adding water to a cake mix, it's not enough.
Not enough.
It's too... It's too automatic. It's too easy. It doesn't seem to require any skill or thought or anything. And you're right. Just egg somehow.
That's right.
You got to crack the egg. You know, it feels
fish
like you're a chef.
Fish out the shells.
Yeah. All of a sudden, you're a chef when you crack the egg into the thing.
That's right.
And we see that in a lot of our – so, for example, even with origami, if we have you make very, very easy origami, it doesn't work because it was too easy. It's almost as though if the bookshelf, all you need to do is screw one screw in. It's not enough, right? Then it's like it was already made. So there's some middle level where it's got to be kind of hard, actually. You have to feel like you did something. And then if it gets too hard, of course, then it can be a problem. But we're really always looking for that sweet spot of enough of yourself into it, not too much so you know, you're bashing the bookshelf and swearing.
And a couple of minutes, we're talking to Michael Norton from Harvard Business School about the IKEA effect. In a couple of minutes, we're going to ask you if you've experienced the IKEA effect at 877-301-8970. You can line up now. If you want. So we always ask you after we listen to your odd research is what do you do with this? I mean, what's the moral of the story? Is an employer listening to the show right now who says – oh, actually, I interviewed Jack and Susie Welch last night about their new book, The Real Life MBA. And in their book, a word that I saw constantly, which was a surprise, was fun. And I'm thinking about that in the back of my head. So what is an employer that wants to create fun, satisfaction, something do with your research so that their people could experience the IKEA effect? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I'll tell you a ridiculous story. So often when I teach executives, these are people who are coming to Harvard Business School to learn more about being good managers. Mm-hmm. I will have them – I'll buy sets of Legos that are meant for three-year-olds. And I'll give them out to these executives. These are people, men and women, who are worth who knows how much. You know, they could buy some Legos if they felt like it, let's say. But I give them these Lego sets for three-year-olds. And they make a little – and I say, you got to put them together. So they make a little, you know, a thing that they made. Maybe it's a little frog or a little dog or something out of the pieces. And then I say, okay, the exercise is over. Can you take them apart and put them back in the jar? And you've never seen a more heartbroken group of people that I'm taking their Legos away from. I mean, it's not only that, but take it apart. It's like murdering your dog that you just made.
Oh, God.
Now, the funny thing about – and the reason I do that to them is because they could buy Legos any day of the week. All of us could. And take 1 minute to put them together and make a thing that we love. But we don't do it. So it's not as – some people say, yeah, I know it's nice to make things, but I'm not going to go out and build a doghouse. I don't have time for that. Little tiny things that you do can be very meaningful. And in fact, I talked to an exec that I taught. He still has the Lego dog that he made on his desk. This is like years later.
So is the point that you should give your employees a little bit of time to do that sort of minor creative thing, even if it's not related to the work that they're doing with you and for you?
Absolutely. And you see companies actually will. So think about what should your cubicles look like? Should they all be standardized or should you let people customize them? Well, a lot of companies want standardization. They want the place to look uniform. Places like Google actually let employees customize. They're working on their own space. And it turns out they have a better time when they're in their space because they got to put themselves into it.
Unbelievable.
What do they do to their space at Google that makes it so exciting? I mean, you just have things – well, tell me.
They do like – so you can do whatever you want, but they'll have like themes. So you could have like a jungle cubicle. Or I mean, they really go pretty hardcore to customize it to yourself. And there's really not a lot of limit on what you can do depending on your job there because they want people to feel as though they made it themselves, that they're in a place that they designed for themselves.
You know, I'm thinking about this. It's just a quick aside. We always have a fight about school uniforms, whether they should be good or should be bad.
Yeah, I'm against the Marjorie's
You often forum. See kids with school uniforms. They have the most elaborate designs on their saddle shoes and the mm-hmm. laces of their shoes or the socks, or they have some way to differentiate their uniform from everybody else, which I always think is fascinating.
So before we take a quick break and then get to the calls at 877-301-8970, you're a relatively humble guy. There were a bunch of you, the three of you who worked on this research. Is that right, three?
That's right.
Who came up with the term, which I think is so perfect. I would say it was you if I were you.
You know,
was
I don't.
It?
I actually don't remember.
Yes, you do.
No, I really don't. I'm not sure. This is work with Daniel Moshan and Dan Ariely. I'm not sure which one of us came up with the term. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been Dan Ariely. Yeah. I wish I could take
well,
credit.
Well, you were such a decent
But if I had
guy,
to guess, I think it was him.
If I had to guess, I would say it was you, actually.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're talking about the IKEA effect, and we're going to take your calls in just a second when we come back. If you've experienced the love of your own labor, have you also experienced the IKEA effect of spending a weekend like Jim assembling the Besta Entertainment Center amount to a long-lasting appreciation of your furniture, even if the shelves sag and the laminate's peeling off? Call us, 897-WGBH. Here's the number, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What's the email, Jim?
I have no idea. BPRWGBH.org.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the IKEA effect with behavioral economist and Harvard Business School professor Michael Norton. He and his colleagues are responsible for the term and the concept. We want to know if you've experienced this, whether it's loving the kitchen cabinets you assembled, even though the doors are always falling off the hinges, or on a more serious note, throwing too much time and resources into a project because of the labor you have already invested in it. There's nothing that captures me better than this sickness. 877-301-8970. Marjorie, well, actually, you do some. The IKEA effect, the cake is the IKEA. I mean, it's just under a different, in a different venue, but it's the exact same thing.
I
you
guess
get
so.
Satisfied. Of course it is, right?
My frosting, spectacular.
Is it or isn't it, Michael Norton? It is, right?
It is. In fact, we've done research where we have people just feel like they're working hard to come up with ideas. So even just mental effort can cause you to say, this is brilliant, because you put, again, just like making a cake or building a bookshelf, you put yourself into it, and that makes you overvalue it.
So are the zillionaires who are who run IKEA, did they know this before there was an IKEA effect, when they said to themselves, we could just sell this crap, their furniture, we could just sell the furniture and deliver it to people or have them put it on the roof of their car, or we could have people assemble it for a slight reduction in cost because of what someday Michael Norton and his colleagues would call the IKEA effect. Did they get that? I assume they did, right? Isn't that part of their business model?
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of the IKEA business model, right, is that – so the usual deal is if you need to put something together, I have to charge you less. That's kind of the deal, because now you're going to do the labor instead of me.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing about what this effect does is I could actually charge you more because you enjoy doing it so much that you'll come back even more. I'll actually – pay you to let me work. And my favorite example is, and this is a real thing, haycations.
What are they?
A haycation, H-A-Y, you pay to work on a farm.
Oh, my God.
Yet I might even do it. It sounds kind of interesting, but what a business model if you're a farmer. You actually get idiots to come and shovel manure and pay you to do it because they want to have an experience where they made a difference and accomplished something.
Haycations. Okay. I love that.
I'm doing that. 877-301-8970. You're talking about the IKEA effect. We want to know if you have – not suffer. I was going to say suffered from. If you have experienced it, let's start with Pete in Framingham. Pete, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, Pete. So I've made a living out of the IKEA effect. I'm a craftsman of furniture and cabinets. So every day I get satisfaction of building things from scratch. And one of the benefits is I get to listen to your show every day.
That's a great benefit. Absolutely.
But I don't want to disabuse you. I'm not this the economist here, but he is a real craftsman. He creates something out of nothing. Those of us who experience the IKEA effect create very little out of somebody else's work, don't we?
Well, we'd have to see Pete's product before we call him a craftsman. I don't know.
Go ahead, Pete. I'm sorry.
The great IKEA effect is to just push it with your hand and have it crumble into a pile and then put it in the dumpster. That's the IKEA effect.
What kind of stuff do you do? Pete, before you go, what kind of work do you? What kind of stuff do you do? What kind of stuff?
I'm a graduate of the North Bennett Street School in Boston, which builds beautiful furniture.
Yes.
So great school, very small, not very well known, but a tremendous asset to the city. And you know, I just get to build cabinets and furniture and create things every day.
That's great. You know, Pete, in all seriousness, I don't know if you've listened to the show through the years, that's my dream in life, is someday to be you. Pete, thank you for the call. So does he get more satisfaction, the generic Pete, not him? And I know this isn't the IKEA effect, it's beyond, but you'll understand this. Does he get more satisfaction because he has a tangible work product than I do because I don't? I mean, yeah. I love what I do, but you know, if the average me and the average him.
It's hard to say. So we did do one study where we got people who describe themselves as do-it-yourselfer people. So these are people – he's probably a lot better than the regular do-it-yourselfer mm-hmm. person. But we wanted to see – other people said, I'm not a do-it-yourselfer person. And we wanted to see if we got both of these groups of people to make stuff, who would like it more. And you can imagine that if you're not a do-it-yourselfer person and I make you make something, you hate it because it's not what you like. It turns out it's totally not true. So even people who say – I don't like to make things. I don't like to hammer things. If we get them to do it, they get just as big a boost as the people who say, this is something that I really like to do. So there does seem to be something in us that even if we don't think we're that kind of guy, mm-hmm. doing a little bit of it can still make us happy.
Well, we just got an email from James who says, brewing my own beer. It was a pre-assembled kit with all the ingredients you'd need. I brewed an Irish red for St. Patrick's Day, and it was delicious. So he got a lot of satisfaction out of it. I mean, I can.
I had a similar experience. I brewed beer twice. I followed all the directions and I did it. It was not nearly as good as anything you'd buy, but it's. I loved it. I totally loved it because I had followed the directions and created.
Or
this
make
thing.
Your own ice cream at home.
By
That's
the way,
that kids
never
do.
Works. By the way, there's actually some follow up research by other researchers showing that one of the things that making things yourself does is it lets you brag about them more.
That's
well, that
true.
Makes total sense.
Because if you buy a TV and brag about it, you're kind of a jerk. But if you make your own beer and talk about it, you know, you're sharing a story, it's an experience, but you still a little bit get to tell everyone that you're an interesting person.
No, that's absolutely true. Let's go to Sean in Marshfield. What do you think, Sean?
Hi, Sean.
I absolutely believe in the IKEA effect. I've put together countless IKEA items, most of which aren't even mine. I have friends that are just like, oh, I need to go IKEA. I'm like, I need to go with you so I can put your stuff together for you.
Really?
And surprisingly, it works out pretty well if it happens to be like a lady friend.
Oh, a date magnet kind of deal. Is that it?
Kind of.
Yeah, good for you, Sean.
That's a different effect. That's not the IKEA effect.
But I can see that, though. Every woman wants a man with a tool belt. I mean, right?
If that's all. Yeah, exactly. Hey, Sean, no, I'm kidding. Sean, thank you very much for the call. You know, other than the woman part of it, I've experienced that too. I mean, I've had moments like that where, I mean, it is the satisfaction of the product. Yes, the thing that you did, it's huge. In any case, let's go back to the phone. Sam, you're on the road. You're on with Michael Norton from the Harvard Business School and Boston Public Radio. Hi, Sam.
Hello, the previous callers, I was a professional assembler at one point, and I did get a lot of satisfaction out of making things for people. And I just had a quick reference to The Wire. McNulty tries to put together a bedroom set from IKEA, mm-hmm. gets frustrated, breaks it, he eventually gets it together. And then several seasons later, Kima tries to put the same bed set together. And when she calls McNulty to ask him what she's doing wrong, he tells her she's using the wrong whiskey.
That's a pretty good story there, Sam. Thank you for the call. 877-301-8897. We're talking about the IKEA effect.
So what other kinds of things? And we mentioned the beer. We got the furniture. I was talking about the cake. You did the Legos. What other kinds of things do people really get revved up about?
You know, a huge part of them actually is artwork. I think that most of us, most of us don't think of ourselves as a do-it-yourselfer. Most of us don't think of ourselves as artists. Actually, we've talked about this before. Little kids all think they're artists.
Yeah.
But right around age 8, 9, 10,
like
we
George
all say,
Bush.
I'm not an artist
with
anymore.
His paintings.
Yeah, so a lot of people later in life will rediscover kind of an artistic sense. And art's a lovely thing because you get both to express yourself and you put some effort into it. So it's another way in which a lot of us are leaving some happiness on the table, that we don't make things ourselves. We don't engage in artistic pursuits. Not that we all have all the time in the world, but a lot of these things don't take that much time, and they can be very satisfying.
You know, I read – I'm going to get this about 50% wrong, so hopefully you'll correct me. There was a survey that came out the other day about postponing or decreasing the likelihood of either dementia or Alzheimer or some comparable thing, and they talked about what the factors were. There was like a 50% reduction if you exercise and did that as you get older. But you know what the highest single thing was, which I'd totally forgotten, like in the 70%? Doing art and those sort of things in older people. So is it, and I assume just it was keeping your cognitive skills sharp. That's what it was. You know, you're nimble and all that sort of thing. Is it possible that it causes a higher level of happiness like this IKEA effect does, that that may be what pushes off these diseases that often hit old people?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, there is certainly research that suggests that when older people feel kind of more in control of their environment, in general, they do better. So people in nursing homes, if you give them some choices for how they spend their day, they tend to do better than if you just say you have to go there, you have to go there, you have to go there. The loss of autonomy is a big deal, obviously, for older people. I don't think anyone's looked at it in this context, but you can imagine that having the freedom to make what you want and build what you want might actually be a good way to allow people to feel that they have some autonomy that they might have otherwise lost.
You know what you said a couple of times today, which I really love? Don't leave some happiness on the table, mm-hmm. or whatever, however you said that. I think that should be the title of your next book. Because if you think about that, if you don't do the kind of the things you want to do. When you say art, it could be anything, I assume. It could be if you learn how to play an instrument when you were a kid, maybe go back to the instrument, or artwork, or other kinds of things. I mean, we have this new show on WGBH about singing.
Sing that thing.
And a lot of these women were talking about being in the singing group was the gave them more happiness than anything else in their life, just going and singing with 50 other women. So it's not all about their ego, because it's they're one of 50, but they're just the best thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about the IKEA effect is, so we make fun of people who have an ugly-looking mug that they think is the greatest mug in the world, and they get so much satisfaction out of it. They're being a little bit silly, but at the same time, it does mean that you don't have to be that good at stuff to really have a great emotional experience. You can make a mug that objectively maybe isn't the best mug in the world, but for you, even if you're an amateur, it still is incredibly meaningful and important. So you don't have to be a master chef or a master builder to get happiness out of making things yourself. Even the amateurish versions can be things that we really like.
You know, I have a feeling that we may be doing too much celebration of the IKEA effect. Someone either tweeted or emailed a question. And is there a downside, Michael Norton? Someone who keeps pouring energy and money into something because of the effort put into the original concept, which is I can't believe I didn't think of that. That's a really good point, isn't it? So is there a downside?
There's two things, actually, that comment makes me think. So one is, if you think of the time value of your money,
Oh, it's like a penny an hour. That is obvious.
Exactly. Yes. So if you have any rational sense of how much your time is worth compared to someone else who could put the bureau together in 5 minutes and you take 12 days, obviously it's ridiculous to not pay somebody to do it. And the other part, of course, is that this phenomenon that's known as sunk costs. And the best way to think about that is throwing good money after bad. We do it with our time and our effort too. So once we start something, we'll stick with it to the bitter end. So there are cases in which we should really just say, you know what,
cut
this isn't
going to
happen for me. Let's just go buy one online. Yeah, and people do that.
But I think the point that the emailer, the tweeter, the texter was making, I think, and I can see this applying to me too, is I probably get more satisfaction out of this than I should. I think better of myself. I don't mean the happiness, the amorphous happiness thing, but I actually think I achieved far more than I really did. I looked at this piece of paper. I separated all the pegs, all the screws, all the whatevers, and basically did something that a chimp could do. And the level of satisfaction is colossal. And it's almost like fooling yourself into thinking, like that first guy, what was his name, Pete? He creates things from scratch. That should create a feeling of great satisfaction. Assembling a bookcase from IKEA, you know, it's nice, but I experience much more joy than I think I should. Isn't that potentially a downside, sort of the fooling of yourself aspect, or no? Why are you laughing?
You know, I hear you, but I think – so whenever we design these happiness interventions, you know, whenever we tell
happiness
people –
happiness interventions.
Whenever we say whatever you're doing isn't so good and you should do this other thing instead, whenever we do that kind of thing, the thing that I always think about is it could be that you're getting more out of it than you should in a sense, but what would you be doing with the time otherwise? Mm. And if you use that time otherwise to do something extraordinary, then maybe you shouldn't be putting the bureau together. But my guess is, like most of us and me, if you weren't putting the thing together, you'd be watching a stupid TV show. So I often think about, compared to what are you being foolish in this case? And if it's less foolish than the other thing you'd be doing, go ahead and make the book case.
Jack just emailed and said, the effect IKEA has on me is that I now see the value in Jordan's Furniture, where they build, supply it, deliver it, and take away the old stuff.
By the way, yeah, for those who've not been to IKEA, you can buy the stuff made. I mean, that's part of your point, isn't it? The comparative value is that it's just, it's surreal.
John in Rhode Island. What do you think, John?
Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi.
First time caller. I love your show.
Well, thank you, John. You.
For
both.
My only IKEA experience, my stepdaughter at age 22 moved back in with us, and we had to find furniture for a very small bedroom. She told me about IKEA, and I had heard about the store but never went. So we spent a Saturday morning, started off first smelling all their beautiful baked goods, which I didn't care to eat, waiting for the store to open, going through the maze of showrooms, the wrong way halfway.
Oh, you can never escape. You can't get out.
Against the grain. But then I got this big cart and went through this warehouse and pulled these big, heavy boxes off and loaded this thing on. And then we got to the checkout where hundreds of people were standing in line. And I thought, oh, my God, are all these people really going to build this stuff? Because I had a plan to march over to the delivery counter and look into delivery and setup. And the woman next to me, with great joy, looked at me and said, what are you building tonight? I said, I'm not building a thing. Someone's going to come to my house and put it all together. And so we went over there, and then for an extra $300, my original $900 purchase went to $1,200. And I simply said to myself, this is the furniture my stepdaughter wants. It fits into the little bedroom. And this, putting it together, just isn't for everyone. And so when the guy came the next day on a Sunday, and I thought, wow, this poor guy has to spend his whole Sunday putting together this furniture. I don't care what he's making, it's not worth it. And he opened the box and he said, oh no. I said, what do you mean, oh no? He said, this is the hardest day bed that IKEA sells to build. He said, the first time, even after going through training, the first time I had to do it alone, it took me 5.5 hours. So I thought, well, okay, I'll be downstairs. Let me know when you're done. And 3.5 hours later, he told me he was complete. He put a daybed, a wardrobe, a desk, a mirror, and bookcase together. And I have to say, he did a great job. We love it. But I would rather just go sell another couple of insurance policies and pay someone to do that work. I mean,
well,
I
you
love
are
it.
One hell of a grown-up, John.
It's just not for everyone.
Yeah.
John, did you try the Swedish meatballs on the way out or not?
No.
They are fabulous.
It was tempting, but it was quite an experience. And, you know, I think it's a great option to do it yourself. And for those who love to, it's kind of like yoga. My wife keeps telling me about yoga and inviting me to go. And I simply say, honey, it's not for everyone.
Hey, John, call again soon. You're a great storyteller.
That was very funny.
Thank you for the call.
This might be my skeptical nature, but I wonder if the guy was working for the entire time when he was up there. So we talked to some locksmiths a while ago, okay? We were interviewing people who work with their hands. We wanted to know more about, you know, what's going on. So we talked to a master locksmith. This is a guy, you'd be amazed. He can go up to a door. He uses it looks like a paper clip. It just, you know, he almost just breathes on the door. Boom, it's open.
Oh.
And he told us basically that when he started, of course, he wasn't very good at being a locksmith because he had to learn. So he'd go to your house and he'd break the door and smash the lock and the door jam would come off and all this stuff. And he'd be sweating and swearing. And then he'd say, that's going to be $150. And people would say, okay. The better he got, the more he would walk up to your door, you know, cool as a cucumber, touch it, it would open, and he'd say, that's going to be $150. People wouldn't pay. They got mad at him because they said, well, you didn't do any work. So he told us he started deliberately using the wrong tools for a little while.
That's great.
Until he got the door open, and then people would pay $150. So this guy who put his furniture together the whole story about 5.5 hours and upstairs forever, he might have been taking a nap.
He might have been. And then you'd feel like you wanted to give the guy a big tip because you go in and you'd see it and you'd think, wow, I'm going to give this guy. We forgot to ask what kind of tip he gave to the guy from IKEA.
Hey, Barbara, Michael Norton, just emails and says, do the IKEA folks like the term? Meaning, do we have any idea if they like the IKEA effect? That's a great question.
I don't
actually.
Know. I don't know, actually. They are not using it, which maybe is a signal of what they think of it. But I think they'd be happy to know that a lot of people get value out of putting their products together.
So if you did, you know, getting back to this, what your personal labor is worth, and I for all of us who have done this, apparently not Marjorie, but it really is true. It's like a nickel an hour.
I've sewed a blouse once by hand.
So if you've done this research, almost everything I come up with you've done already. But here's this one. If you told people how many hours it was going to take to build that CD thing, and it's either going to cost you $40 more to buy the thing completed, or it's going to take you 40 hours, which means it's going to be $1 an hour for your labor. Would that affect, or is there an inherent joy in the assembly that has no relationship, even if you're told up front what the impact's going to be?
If I asked you that question with you putting together a bureau, if I said, hey, this thing's going to take you all weekend, you might be thinking, this will take me an hour.
That's what I do. I'd say you're out of your mind. It won't take me that long.
Exactly.
But and even you said, if I yes, convinced it would. You, I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I think
is.
You still – my guess is it might help a little bit. So usually when you get people to think about opportunity costs, you know, you say, I'm going to drive 800 miles to get cheaper gas.
I've done that.
And you say, well – just stop for a second and think about that, because you'd be using more gas. People say, yeah. I'm going to drive 800 miles to get cheaper gas. So it can help a little. Some people it helps a little bit. But honestly, a lot of us are, we're going to do what we're going to do. And it's hard.
De-bias it's more emotion
right
than fact, right?
That's right. Exactly. If you want to make something and feel good about it,
you want to
I can
it.
Give you all the Excel yeah. spreadsheets I want, but you want to make something and feel good about it.
Michael Norton, one last question for me. You probably haven't done the research on this, but I always wonder if like the people that can figure these things out and put things together, were they good in geometry, or what is their deal? Because you do notice there's a much different aptitude, not having necessarily practice. Like if you've got 3 kids, one of them could put it together and the other two are like helpless. So what's that about?
I don't know actually what the predictors are of being really good at these kinds of things. Although at the same time, what we find is, again, it's almost independent of whether you're good or bad at it.
You can get
a lot of joy
that.
Out of it, yeah. Which is kind of funny. But I don't know the things that actually truly make people good or bad.
Because you do see, like if you see someone, you know, when I found a difficult thing, like the IKEA bureau, having to have somebody put it together. And they put it together in like 10 minutes. And I was there with the nuts and the screws and the paper and the bolt. You know what I mean?
We should put it in context. Yes. He probably hasn't heard the story that I told a few weeks ago when Marjorie, after owning her flat screen TV for 5 years, said, yeah, I really have to get one of those HD TVs, until her friend who helped her put it up said, you own an HDTV. Let's take one more because this is too much fun.
I may be an extreme case.
Sean, you're in Boston. You're on Boston Public Radio with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. We're talking about the IKEA effect. Hey, Sean.
Hi.
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 Take my call.
Sure.
I totally believe in the IKEA effect. I think that it's like adult Legos. I think Legos have better directions, but it's really fun to try and like put that stuff together. I called because I recently started knitting, and that's like creating something from nothing, like Crafts and Pete was.
Yeah.
But I find that my problem is that, I mean, it's nice because I can do it while I'm watching stupid TV, but it takes so much time that I then have to, like, justify the mistakes. And it doesn't matter, like, how badly I screw up, say, a hat or a pattern or whatever, I'm still going to wear that hat, even though it doesn't look good. And I'm still going to, like, tell people that it's supposed to look like that. Like, justify to myself that what I was doing is really worth the time, even though you can buy a nice knitted hat for about $10 or $15.
Sean, you're great.
Oh,
that was
Sean,
great.
Sean, my sister, and I hope she's not listening, she's a big knitter. She did it to quit smoking.
I didn't know she was a big
yeah,
knitter.
Yeah, she is. And she'll make a scarf, but it'll be way too short. You know, it's like the scarf is supposed to go down below your hips. And the scarf starts, you know, start like in the middle of your
chest. Well, I can match that.
Yeah. And she just, it's great. Don't worry about it. It's beautiful. It looks great on you. You think, this is horrible.
Do they still have things called Raya rugs, or was that of another time? Whatever it was this rug. When I was in law school, I was looking for something to distract me from the monotony of the work. And I decided I would make a Raya rug. And what a basic – well, I don't have to tell you what it is. I mean, it's mindless. But you make this rug. It was – and this harkens back to that – maybe the ugliest thing that – no, I'm serious – that man or woman has ever seen. I would never throw it away. I put it on the wall, and I may have had it for 20 years. It was an eyesore of epic. Not only was it poorly put together, it was ugly to begin with. The pattern was ugly. It was outdated, but it was my thing. You are so dead on with
this.
So
do you do this? Incredible. Do you make stuff?
Of course he does.
I don't. I actually don't.
You don't?
I have so little aptitude to make things with my hands, but I was a musician, and we actually have been looking at how creating music in a way is a the harder you had to try to learn a song, the better you think you are at playing it, independent of how good you actually are at playing it.
Well, can I make a deal? You know,
that's a great one.
Michael, do you need a bookcase? I'm willing to come over. We'll drive to wherever it is.
If you
we'll
could
buy
me a pre-assembled one.
No, I'm willing to put it together for you.
We'll
Michael
talk.
Norton, you are great, and the research is great. Thank you.
Michael Norton is a behavioral economist, a professor at Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. I think his next book should be Happiness Left on the Table. What was the expression you said?
Leaving happiness on
Leaving
the table.
Leaving happiness on the table. Boy, I'd hate to be in your deathbed thinking of all the happiness you'd left on the table. That'd really bum you out, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you so much for being here, Michael. Coming up, we talk to the creative force behind the Gold Dust Orphans. Ryan Landry joins us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, who is the man who has given us the plexiglass menagerie, Phantom of the Opera, and now Thoroughly Muslim Millie, and more. And we're talking about writer, performer, founder of the Gold Dust Orphans. That, of course, would be Ryan Landry. He is also the winner, as Jared told us the other day. He's also the winner of this year's Elliot Norton Prize for Sustained Excellence. Joining us is the excellent Ryan Landry. Ryan, it's great to see you.
Oh, it's so good to see both of you.
It's great to see you, too. So tell people all about this hysterically funny. And Jared Bowen gave it a rave review. He was just thrilled with Thoroughly Muslim. Millie.
What's the deal?
Yeah, well, it's a great show. I mean, we get a standing ovation every night. But I have to say, the funniest part about it is I've gotten a bunch of emails and warnings that something bad is going to happen. And that's just not the case. Yeah, it's so funny because I don't know much about the Muslim culture. Parts of it look quite beautiful. Other parts look strange to me. But the show is really, the villains in the show are not Muslims. It's not a Muslim-hating show. The villains are actually...
Oh, you're worried actually, about Muslim blowback.
So, yeah, the villains are actually Dick and Lynn Cheney.
Love them.
Yeah, who kidnapped the Prince of Persia to steal his oil. But, you know, why I brought that up was because it's so funny how people were saying, have you gotten a lot of blowback from it and this sort of thing? But that's not happened at all. In fact, I've gotten more emails about warning me or saying that they hate Muslims or something from people I don't even know. And I've sent I've sent the script to people who I've become friends with because of the show who are Muslim, who actually thought it was a riot. So it's just funny how the more... I got more blowback from people who dislike the Muslim culture, probably because they know nothing about it, and nothing from actual people who are practicing Muslims.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Well, I
assume
you get more mail from people who are upset. Don't you execute Julie Andrews like in 3 minutes
tell us
in this
about
thing?
That.
I don't know why. I should be getting mail about that. Yeah. She just gets up on the mountaintop and she sings, "The hills are alive" with the sound, and then all of a sudden a helicopter comes in and they blow her away with machine guns, and then she blows up in fire.
Since when are you worried about offending people?
Excuse me, tell people why, because she was the original.
Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Yeah, Thoroughly Modern Millie.
See, why are you worried about offending people all of a sudden?
Not worried about it. I find it funny, Jim. I just find it. I find it odd.
He found it unexpected.
I found it unexpected.
Exactly.
That the people who would be offended by this were not the Muslims, but people who just blindly hate Muslims.
Now, Ryan Landry, I'm going to do a quiz for you. I'm coming to see this the week after this. Yeah. And I'm going to give you a little hint about something I'm guessing you don't know about the Cheneys. You ready for this?
Yes.
Lynn Cheney wrote a book that should interest you many, many years ago. It is out of print. Marjorie Egan and I read excerpts from it on the air on our former radio show at great length. Do you know what the book was called and do you know what the subject matter was? And people think this is made up, but it's not. Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney, former vice president.
The book was called My Filthy Dreams.
It's close, actually. It is close.
It is close.
You don't know. You want the name of the book? Is?
Yeah.
Sisters is the name of the book, and it is a raunchy
lesbian
love story written by Lynn Cheney. Yes.
You're kidding.
No.
I'm
well, then you're
going
to love
you,
this
yes.
because Mary Cheney is one of the stars of Thoroughly Muslim Millie. She actually comes over to Persia and falls in love with the lesbian princess of Persia. And the bad things happen to them at the end, unfortunately. Oh, I can't. That's a spoiler alert, as the young people
alert.
Call it. I can't say anymore.
So tell people about your theater, because it's very different where you put on your productions.
Well, it's not a theater. It's a nightclub.
Nightclub.
But I turned it into a theater, you know.
You got cocktails?
Oh, yeah, plenty. Are you kidding? Well, we used to do a lot of drinking before the shows, but now we wait until the end. But the audience can drink all through the show.
Which is kind of a fun thing for people.
Absolutely. Why not?
So they're sitting at tables and having cocktails or
no.
regular chairs?
They sit at chairs. The chairs are padded. It's all very comfy. You know, I mean... it's not a traditional theater in the sense that there aren't, like, you know, ushers dressed in, like, little 30s outfits or anything. It's just kids in T-shirts that say the Goldust Orphans, and they help you to your chair. And then you get to have a drink and hang out. And actually, the funny part about it is our audience started almost 100% gay male audience. And now I think 75% of our audience are about middle-aged heterosexuals who love it. Yeah, they think it's a riot. And especially the older ladies love the dirty jokes, you know. And there's plenty for that. I keep plenty on hand.
But this is not, you know, the Goldust Orphans. I have to say, I sort of had a sense of what I was in for before I went for the first time a couple of years ago. But you wouldn't say it's for everybody, would you?
I would.
You would? Yeah, well,
I think anyone with a sense of humor. You know, I find it so funny that there's gay, straight. I still find it funny that we're such a misogynist culture. I don't understand black, white, gay, straight, male, female. You know, there's just two kinds of people in this world. Good ones and I can't say the other word while
I
on
like
your
that.
Show.
Yeah,
that's
can we
lovely.
Step aside from Thoroughly Muslim Millie for a second? Yeah. Since you were unfamiliar with Sisters, I'm going to give you a little information here.
Hit me.
On the cover, there's a picture of 19th century ladies in bonnets. Now, you'd be into that, right?
Yeah.
You'd look great in a bonnet. Yeah, the women's
bonnets and discipline.
Exactly. Freedom League standing behind two dark-haired lovelies. The teaser on the cover, you're going to love this, read, "The novel of a strong and beautiful woman who broke all the rules of the American frontier." I mean, does it get any better than that, Ryan Landry?
Honey, I broke all the rules of my American frontier around 15 years old.
Well, I think you and Lynn Cheney might have something to talk about. We were all
don't think me and Lynn Cheney have anything to talk about, except for the fact that after Dick... Well, I can't tell you what happens to Dick in my show,
but
Lynn becomes the princess of Persia, and she becomes the leader of Persia and gets all the money and all the oil, Lynn. And she gets beat to death with a guitar by Cat Stevens. I can't say much more.
Oh, God.
But she's pretty genius.
So I read, Ryan Landry, where these kind of the titles of your plays, which are wonderful, like The Plexiglass Menagerie and Thoroughly Muslim Millie, kind of come to your head. And then you create the show around it. Is that so?
That is so, yeah. We all get drinking, you know, after a show. And then we start laughing about the shows we'd like to do in the future and stuff. It's a very close-knit group. It's about 50 orphans have been in the company for the last 20 years. It's sort of satellite. Some come and do all the shows in 1 year. Some only do one show a year. Some don't do shows for 3 or 4. But we are very... We laugh a lot, and we enjoy each other's company, and it's just grown as a company. I can't believe it. It's just so hilarious.
So is that part of how it happens, though, with everybody sitting around coming up with these ideas?
Oh, yeah. We're just drinking and having fun. Somebody acts goofy, and then if the title's really bad, we all, like, boo him. And if it's really good, we go, hey. You
so
know
does this
I mean?
Award mean something?
Like, suddenly Last Supper. We just came up with that one.
I like that too.
Yeah.
So winning this Elliot Norton
suddenly
thing,
Last
what Jared Bowen says to us is a huge deal. Is that, how much does that matter to you?
Well,
what does matter to you?
What matters to me? I don't like bad architecture.
Okay.
Really?
I don't like, you know, Walgreens. Yeah. Can I just say this publicly?
Bad.
I am so sick of having phony bell towers in strip malls in Massachusetts. Stop it. Okay? Just build it out of wood or don't build it. I don't know what's going on.
But... Wait a minute. What do you mean bell towers?
Oh, we can't get into this.
We can't?
No, I'll get so upset.
Okay,
so what does matter? Is it money? Is it fame?
No.
Is it recognition? Is it awards? Is it laughing? What do you care about, Ryan?
You know, the sound of laughter makes me live. And other than that, I don't know. You know, my friend Loretta LaRoche, do you know who she is? She's pretty good. She said to me one time, the secret of life is keep yourself distracted till you're dead. And I really...
That's so beautiful.
Isn't that a beautiful thought? And I agree with it totally. And I think that what matters is just, you know, do your best, do good, and make people happy, and then you'll be happy.
What did you say what did you say, the supper, the what supper?
Suddenly Last Supper.
Suddenly Last Supper. Yeah. Is that your shirt, the Suddenly Last Supper shirt? I know, you have like
a Jesus Christ kind of thing going on. From New Orleans, because we're thinking of moving down to New Orleans for a while.
Why? Oh, why?
Yeah,
why?
Well, we'll still be doing shows here in Boston, you know, because we love New Orleans and the people, and we just want a little bit of a change, but we can't talk about that either, because that's just like the architecture. It'll get me so upset.
Yeah. So, I just want to ask you one thing, though. Are there bells on Walgreens that I'm missing? What bell towers?
No, you know what I mean. You've seen it. Those crappy, weird, you know, that they have these facades that are like, I don't know what they're made of. You see them?
Yeah, I do.
They're all over the place. It's sort of make it to look like it's New England-y, but they don't go the extra effort.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
I see what you're saying.
Hey, Ryan Landry, let's get back to your work for a second here, if you don't mind. last time you were here, this is in my head, and I may get slightly wrong because it was a couple of years ago.
I was here 6 months ago.
Whatever it was. You seem to be a wildly relaxed, loose kind of person, but either you use the term to describe yourself or one of your players used the term. Didn't they describe you as like a Nazi in rehearsal? Was that you describing yourself?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So is that a fair, I mean, seriously, is that what you become? Is that why you're a perfectionist or what are you?
I just, you know, it's the style is very particular and you just have to hit it. It's like music. You know, if the French horn doesn't come in two beats after the triangle, then something's wrong.
Yeah.
And I just have an issue with that. So I really do put my actors through the paces, but they are so great. The Golden Servants are the greatest in the world because most of them were hired on the spot. For instance, they would come to a show and I'd be like, "You an actress?" And she'd be like, "No." And I'm like, "You're hired." And then this girl said, like Robin, my friend Robin Brodricks, hasn't left the orphans. She's just somebody that came to a show and I was like, "You're hired." I just liked her. So it has to do with energies, you know, and having a good sense of humor. You know.
Is there anybody, you know, your stuff is so different and so original. There probably isn't anybody that was, or maybe there is, that was sort of inspiring you when you were just a...
Oh, yes, there was. Charles Ludlam, yeah. He was a great, great playwright, yeah.
I don't know him.
I don't know him either.
Yeah,
what's,
he was
what's
a great playwright in New York City Underground and in the 70s, and or he died of AIDS in 86, and he was my hero. Back when I was, you know, 15, 16 in the streets of New York.
That's right.
Yeah, I would go and I would use the money I made and I would go to the Ridiculous Theatrical Company, which was on One Sheridan Square.
That was his name?
In New York
the
City.
Ridiculous?
I used to work
so that's the name of the company, yeah. Mm-hmm. One Sheridan Square.
I worked
Square.
Right there. Oh. You yes, right I did. There. Not in that building, but right there, yeah.
And so I would go down there and spend all my money. And then finally, they just started letting me in for free because I was there every night studying them and I loved them.
And what was it?
It was a company much like the Orphans that would do things either based on classic works or totally original pieces. The reason that I do so many things based on things and not just straight on original is I got a lot of mouths to feed and we have to do a lot of shows per year.
But, you know, the fact that you do a lot of familiar music with changing the lyrics, I think that's I think that works tremendously.
It does in today's day and age when people like familiarity. I don't think it would pass in the 80s. It passes now, and that's okay. I used to write all my original music and hire the band and everything, but it was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that I can't afford. And so karaoke tracks do the job, and I think basically I'm a much stronger lyricist than I am a composer. So blah, blah. Anyway, it works and people love it, and it's just so funny that I'm getting this award, the biggest award that they give.
By the way, it is. You think Ryan Landry is making fun of everything.
Huge.
It is the biggest award in the industry, if I can call it that.
In New England.
Huge.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Yeah, in New England theater, it would be the biggest award.
When I was a young cub reporter, he was at the Boston Herald.
Was that so?
Which would be the Boston Herald American. Probably the most esteemed critic. I mean,
I can't imagine you as a cub reporter.
I was
Did
a
you
cub
have like a little
she was
a cub baseball
That's
hat
right.
that
yeah.
was gone,
That's
a little
right.
jaunty
my
to
little
the
notebook,
side?
My little notebook. But he was at when I first got there, and he was legendary.
Who, Elliot Norton?
Elliot Norton was
yeah.
absolutely legendary, and you know, just this old kind of Brahmin type.
Well, was
you know,
he a sweet old queen, or was he kind of mean?
I don't know. Was he a queen? I don't know.
With a name like Elliot Norton, I would hope so.
I have no idea, but he was just
I'll probably get my
award
taken away from me now that I said he's a queen.
Ryan Landry, what have you not done? I don't. What is there that in your head that you're saying, I'm going there?
Well, we haven't made a film yet, and that's so funny because after all the people that have come to the orphans over the years, I haven't really met a lot of filmmakers, and I think it's time that we do make one. And I'm looking for actual filmmakers who could handle my, hard work ethic. But that's what I want to do next. And I want to bring Thoroughly Muslim Millie to New York. I'm working that out right now. And
where do you go in New York?
In January
where,
this
though?
Year. Oh, at Theater 80. We've done two shows in New York
okay.
so far. They're both great. Got a big, great review in the New York Times. A full, almost full page review, rave review of our show, Mildred Fierce. So.
How different is the audience?
Fierce.
They're snotty.
It's not a year in New York
they
City.
They sit there with their arms across their chest, you know, a lot of them. But we break them after a while. By the second act, they're having a good time. But they're not like the Boston. I mean, our Boston audiences are the most lovely people in the world. We get everything from, like, people flying in from all over the country that used to live in Boston that come see the shows. And we get bikers and we get, like, lawyers and people who, you know, are scrounging up the money to pay for the ticket and people who could buy 2,000 tickets. And,
well, can I tell you, I'm so glad you said that, because I asked you before about whether or not it was for a certain kind of person. One of the things you do when I came for the first time is you look at you spend as much time looking at the audience.
Yeah.
As because you're sitting next to somebody who's 82 years old, who looks like they just came in from Iowa, and somebody said there's a really funny play that you should go see. And it is it really is amazing. What you said is true, is that despite the wild diversity of the audience, everybody gets into it because it is about as much fun as live performance can be. Speaking of fun, since we're on the subject and you're asking me a lot of questions about Sisters.
Yes, let's
be,
get back to Sisters,
I'm read
Jim,
you,
please.
I'm going to
read
you a passage.
This friggin' book. I'll
By the way,
the
I still can't
it.
Believe you don't know this. This is an excerpt.
I know the
this?
Brian De Palma movie Sisters.
Can I read from this, please?
Please.
This is Lynn Cheney.
Secretly
please,
the star of that?
The hardest thing any human being can do, a woman in the novel declares, is fully to acknowledge the actuality of another. You'd agree with that. Is that not true?
Absolutely.
I'm talking
I would
to you,
too,
Ron.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not done. To admit, truly admit that their thoughts, cares, their ardors and aversions were as real as our own. Could you not do something with that? Come on, my friend.
Our
ardors and aversions.
It sounds
are
like they eat too much butter. They're hardened their ardors.
Lynn had to be careful because it had to kind of walk that fine line, you know, when she was first writing her lesbian potboiler.
She turned her daughter gay with that novel.
That's right.
That's
absolutely what happened. I wonder if Dick knew about the lesbian potboiler before they went down the aisle.
You don't think he loved every minute
Actually,
of it?
Actually, I think they got married. I think she wrote it after they were married.
But wait a second. Wasn't Dick Cheney...
Could be a kinky side.
Wait a second.
Weren't
we all... I hope I don't get this wrong.
Hey, that's a good name for a lesbian restaurant. The Potboiler.
That's coming, too. Maybe open a restaurant after you do a film.
Oh, why not?
Okay, so Thoroughly Muslim Millie. How long is that around, Ryan
Until
Landry?
May 10th, and it's playing Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays at 8 and Sundays at 5 at Machine at 1254 Boylston Street.
Is there a website or some such thing?
Oh, it's just, you know, we don't even put up posters anymore. Y'all just come. Oh,
okay.
You can get the tickets on. You can get the tickets on brownpapertickets.com.
Brownpapertickets.com.
Congratulations, Ryan. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's great to see you guys.
Ryan's
I love you.
A writer, performer, head of the Gold Dust Orphans. The latest production we're talking about, Thoroughly Muslim Millie on stage now. We just said at Machine Nightclub. Thank you so much,
and
Ryan.
Soon to be the owner of Potboiler, the lesbian vegan restaurant.
Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we have Ask the Mayor with the Mayor of the City, Marty Walsh, will be here to take our questions and yours. Our show's a production of WGBH. Real quick, no time for you, Jim. Sorry. Chelsea Murray, Will Rosa, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, John Parker, our team. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you for tuning in.